After he had journeyed, and his feet were sore, and he was tired, he came upon an orange grove, and he rested. He lay in the cool, and while he rested, he took to himself an orange and tasted it. And it was good. And he felt the earth to his spine, and he asked. And he saw the tree above him, and the stars, and the veins in the leaf, and the light, and the balance. And he saw magnificent perfection, whereon he thought of himself in balance, and he knew he was. And he thought of those he angered, for he was not a violent man. And he thought of those he hurt, for he was not a cruel man. And he thought of those he frightened, for he was not an evil man. And he understood. He understood himself. On this, he saw that when he was of anger, or knew hurt, or felt fear, it was because he was not understanding. And he learned compassion. With his eye of compassion, he saw his enemies, like unto himself, and he learned love. Then he was answered.
Hi, good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, September 14, 2015. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern to midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-562-3140. Participant code is 385-698. Radio hosts are invited into the queue if they have any questions or a comment. If anyone would like to email a question, send it to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. And please support our business partners. You can see their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance's effort to save America. Also, please support National Liberty Alliance by donating $5 or more. You can click on a donation tab up on the top right. And we'll start off tonight, as we always do, with God's Word. And tonight's scripture reading is Proverbs chapter 13. We're going to be looking at 14, verse 14, and we'll be reading through to, maybe I'm looking at the wrong scripture, hang on a minute, it's 13, I'm sorry. Okay, chapter 13. We're going to be picking up on verse 14, and we're going to be reading through to the end of verse 25. Okay, the law of the wise is a fountain of life, to depart from the snares of death. Good understanding giveth favor, but the way of transgressors is hard. Every prudent man dealeth with knowledge, but a fool layeth open his folly. A wicked messenger falleth into mischief, but a faithful ambassador is health. Poverty and shame shall be to him that refuseth instruction, but he that regardeth reproof shall be honored. The desire accomplished is sweet to the soul, but it is an abomination to fools to depart from evil. He that walketh with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed. Evil pursueth sinners, but to the righteous good shall be repaid. A good man leaveth an inheritance to his children, children's children, and the wealth of the sinner is laid up for the just. Much food is in the tillage of the poor, but there is that is destroyed for want of judgment. He that spareth his rod hateth his son, but he that loveth him chasteneth him betimes. The righteous eateth to the satisfying of his soul, but the belly of the wicked shall want. Okay, that was Proverbs chapter 13, verses 14 through 25. By the way, this week we did start our Bible studies. For those who don't know, we have a Bible study now on Sundays at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. So anybody who doesn't attend any place on a Sunday and would like to get into a Bible study, you're welcome to join us right here in this Monday night room. We do have a page set up for this if you go to nationallibertyalliance.org. This may move, but right now it's under the civics course, and you can click on Sunday Bible Study, and it'll give you all the details and information on joining us on our Bible study. We had our first Bible study last week, and of course this week, next Sunday, shall I say, we'll have another study. And we are looking in at the harmony of the Gospels. We don't particularly have a subject matter today. We're going to talk, though, a little bit about organization, and we're building up our ranks. You know, the purpose of National Liberty Alliance ultimately is to facilitate knowledge and organization, communications. And it was brought to our attention as we were looking, because we always tell people we're not really a group, we're not really an organization. Although we may look like one, we really aren't. And we've come to, I think, to define this as an assembly. Just as the Constitution, we have the right to assembly. We're that assembly. We, the people, are assembling to take our nation back. They have totally destroyed everything, and we need to bring it back to order. They brought us into chaos. And there's only one way to do that, and that, of course, is to bring the king back into the court. Our founding fathers understood who the king was. They defined him, and he is defined in the Bible, ultimately. And so the king of our court is God. It's righteousness. As a matter of fact, the word justice, according to Blacks, according to Broviers, the word righteousness is synonymous with virtue. And virtue is understood through the Bible as the qualities of God. And with that being said, I just want to take a quick look at this idea of virtue, because virtue builds up a path to salvation on the one hand, and it also builds up the path to wisdom, and it builds up the path to success in what we here at National Liberty Alliance is doing. If we can return virtue, or justice, whichever word you would want to use, if we can return virtue into our courts, we can succeed as returning America back and resetting the clocks back to 1779. This is our goal, is to bring justice, to bring the king of the court back into play here, and turn the justice over to him. You know, men know in their hearts, God said that the truth is written in our hearts as far as we know what is right and what is wrong. So it's written in the hearts of men. But I'd like to just read this. We've read this maybe a couple of months ago, but I'd like to read it again because I think it identifies, of course, with this idea of virtue and the path we're taking, and one of the main reasons why we are given a Bible study. Because, again, we need to know the king if we're going to represent the king of the court. And this comes out of 2 Peter chapter 1. And I think I'll read the whole chapter here, or maybe not the whole chapter, but I think I'll start in verse 1 and I'll take it up to verse 11. Simon Peter, a servant and an apostle of Jesus Christ, to them that obtained like precious faith with us through the righteousness of God and our Savior Jesus Christ. Grace and peace be multiplied unto you through the knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord. According as his divine power hath given unto us all things that pertain unto life and godliness, through the knowledge of him that hath called us to the glory and virtue, whereby are given unto us exceeding great and precious promises, that by these ye might be partners of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust. And besides this, given all diligence, add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, and to knowledge temperance, and to temperance patience, and to patience godliness, and to godliness brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness charity, and that is love. For if these things be in you and abound, they make you that you shall neither be barren nor unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. But he that lacketh these things is blind, and cannot see afar off, and hath forgotten that he was purged from his old sins. Wherefore, the rather, brethren, give diligence to make your calling and your election sure. For if you do these things, ye shall never fall. And for it is in this fashion an entrance shall be ministered unto you abundantly into the everlasting kingdom of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Okay, there was 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 1 through 11. So again, we are working on organizing. We're working on leadership. Leadership must have integrity. We must have virtue. Or if you want to use the word justice, we must be just. We must have justice. We must restore justice into our courts. That's our goal. And the only way we're going to succeed in that, of course, is if the people step up and put it back there. And, of course, the people need to know what that is to put it back into it. And, of course, we find this under common law, which leads us right back to the law of God. You know, we have Thomas Jefferson, who was really the founder of the processes that we have. He is the guy that did the studying in history to discover America's process of law and process of government. And he got his information. It started off ultimately with Israel back in about, goodness, if I recall, about 1600 B.C., I think it was. And it was 400 years of perfect, beautiful government, justice in the courts, success far beyond any nation that ever was on the face of this earth. And then they lost it all when they gave up the king of the court. And they wanted a man as a king. And then they got what they asked for. Now, we the people did not ask for a man as a king, but men as kings have taken control. These judges in our courts today act as if they are kings, and for they are in chancery court, so therefore they are kings. Whatever they say is the law. It doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter what you say. It doesn't matter what you think. And they've gotten so bold that they feel that they're so untouchable because they've been doing this for a long time, and they've set up all these little programs and plans to default everyone out of the system, and it's worked so well that they are not afraid of anything. But I do have to say, I truly believe this, that they are afraid of us. Our success is pretty huge. We sent out a request for people to assist us with funding because we've got a lot to do and not much money to do it with. We did get a good response from some people. You know, we had a couple of people actually gave us $1,000. I want to thank them very much for that. And we've had one or two people who gave us $500 and a few that gave us $100, but most people, and some $50, but most people gave $5 and $10. And that is the widow's mite. That $5 and $10 ultimately is what really keeps us going every month after month after month. But it is that extra help with that extra money where people can give us more that takes us to that place where we can start doing things in the courts and getting the papers out. We have about 100. Probably more. I think it might even be 150, but I really am not sure yet. But we have about 100 habeas corpuses that we're going to need to file in the courts, and we're trying to do that as soon as possible. We're training people and working on organizing and training to get this done. And I think we're very close. I keep saying that every week, but we do fall behind week by week because we just don't, get concluded some of the things we need to conclude and finalize. And we're working on that diligently. But every one of those cases represents about $30. It costs us $30 to do every case for the cost of the mailing. And we do ask the people to send money. We've got a lot of cases. We've got a lot of CPS cases, probably about 50. I think I have about 30 in my right now in the queue, or going into the queue. And we have, I think, about 30 to 60 more. So we got quite a few of them. And most of those people, when we were taking those papers, we never asked them for any money because we never ask anybody for money. But it was brought to our realization that we don't have the money to do this. Not that it costs much. But if people, offset the costs, which is about $30 per case, that will really help us sufficiently. But there are some people who can't afford the money. And we don't want to charge people. I mean, if they only got $5 to give us, that's good. Just give us a little something, even a buck. I think, people need to give at least something if they're going to do something for them. But even more than that, everybody that has these things done for them need to understand freely you have received from freely you should give. You're now committed to give to the next person. You understand the process of how people can be saved of their homes and their children that are being robbed from their homes, and the elderly and their estates that are being robbed from their families, and people being incarcerated for real silly things. And we're able to do something for them, and they in return should return that and work with National Liberty Alliance to help others in any way they can. And so, of course, we do ask that people do that, and you follow your own conscience on that. But anyway, the people that are in the courts, they understand how serious the problems are. They understand how unjust our courts are and that people don't win in the courts anymore. They haven't for quite some time. Always the corporation, all the fat cats, they're the guys that win. And, of course, the lawyers and the judges, they win the most. They just rake it in so much money. And you'd be surprised at how some of this money comes to them. But in any event, again, we need to do what we have to do. So, again, continue to give, and especially those who have never given. Take a moment and think about it, what we're doing. Look at the successes that we have. We have about 4,400 members, a little over that. And we have 1,322 county organizers. And this is what we've constructed and built an organization over the past 2.5-3 years. We have 115 state coordinators. We have 6 national leaders, coordinators. I think we have 7 or 8 different committees going on. We have 80 people who have joined up into the writing course to learn to write and to help us write all these habeas corpuses and learning to write other things also, other writs and other paperwork. We have, I forget on the courts, the courses. Let me just click a button real quick and we'll see what's going on in the course. And we did define this in a newsletter that we sent out last week when we were asking for people to assist us in donations so that we can continue to go forward and continue with our plan. We have 879 people that have signed up, enrolled in our courses. It's a free course, 120-hour course, totally free. And when you get through this course, you'll understand exactly how America got to where we are today and how serious the problem is. You'll also learn true American history, common law, process procedure, the Constitution. We cover a lot in this course, 120 hours. We have a total of 463 people that have volunteered to become administrators, which will eventually become a paid position within your counties. And we have a total of 119 people who have already completed this course. So we really have built up our ranks. We've created something, a system where people can learn and finally step up and fight back and take their country back. We filed 10 papers in 94 federal district courts, and we have copied every one of those 10 papers to every elected official on the federal level and the state level, including FBI special agents in charge, including all U.S. marshals, including all of the county sheriffs, and we've also even sent to the Joint Chief of Staff. I think there's 7 or 8 of those guys up there. We sent copies to them, too. We've sent out to over 6,000 media outlets across the nation. And we have done this, all of those, every time, by fax, for all 10 of these papers. I think we're just catching up on the 10th paper to get everything out. And we're working on that now. The fax is up and burning. And I don't know if it's burning tonight, but definitely will be burning tomorrow. But with that fax will be going on all the time. We're just constantly sending these papers out to people. But we also, to the people who are addressing, we addressed the governors of all 50 states a couple of months, I forget exactly how long, when Jade Helm was coming in, it was really pressing, and we saw troops moving all over the place and materials stockpiled here, and they started to gear up to let us know they're coming down and they're going to be pulling tanks into our streets, cutting off intersections, knocking on doors, and making believe they're doing arrests and parachuting out or coming down off of helicopters into the middle of major cities. And they were supposed to do this a while back. And we just in time, I would say, with maybe a week or two to spare, we got out our papers to the governors, and we let them know in no uncertain terms if they did this, that they would be guilty of subversion. And we, the people, would be looking at an indictment for them. For subversion against the United States of America, against the people of their own country, their own states. And we also send this copy out to every elected official in America, as I said, on both levels, and including the FBI. We let the FBI know everything we're doing. So when a judge gets upset and they try to send the FBI out and give them just a little bit of information, we already send it to them already. They got it already. And so do the marshals. They got it too. And so does the Joint Chief of Staff. And so do the militias. So we've sent it out to everyone. We have been busy. There is no liberty group in America as busy as we are. There is no liberty group in America that has been as successful as putting these people on the run as we are. We get things all the time. We hear little stories here and little stories there where judges are backing off when they get to hear and know about what we're doing. We get people begging us to, you know, they're going to obey the law. For instance, we had a sheriff down in Long Island, and he got so many calls. The secretary said to one of our people, please tell the people stop calling. And the sheriff says he will obey the law. And this is what the people need to do. You want to save America? This is it right here. The assembly of the people and facilitating their actions, their education, is National Liberty Alliance, facilitating them with an education. A place to come, to gather, to assembly, a place to organize, to bring together, to learn, to understand the process and procedures of law. And as Jefferson said, if a people expect to be ignorant and free, forget about it. It's not going to happen. It never was and never will be. So this is what we're doing. And if you think that this is what we should be doing, and if you think that this is the solution, and I know it's the solution, it's the only solution, there's no other solution out there, we are it. You need to back us. You need to support us. You need to support us with both your money and your time. And we're only asking for $5 a month. Of course, if you can pay more and donate more, give us more. But $5 a month, please. $5 a month. That's less than the tax you pay probably per week on your cup of coffee and donut and roll in the morning or whatever. Probably less than 1 week. And so it's not a lot of money, and for those who can afford more, please consider more. And we do appreciate from time to time that extra big one we get. We do get $1,000 here, $100 here, and believe me, it always comes in the nick of time. But now, you know, our big project, which we're gearing up for, is U.S. Congress. And that's going to cost us about, I think we calculated somewhere $600-$700 just in mailing alone. To get it out to all, I believe it's 540. We've got 440 congressmen and 100 senators. But I think they added a few. I think Washington's got a senator or something. I don't know. They've done some crazy stuff, and there's something going on with congressmen also in territories. So there's a few more than what we normally should have. And by the way, we the people didn't ordain and establish those things for these territories or for Washington to be a state of some kind. Again, they just do whatever they please. And until we the people put our foot down and tell them enough is enough, and we're coming out to you against you for subversion against the United States of America, against we the people, unless you stop and start doing the right thing. 99% of what Congress puts out in legislature is unconstitutional, null, and void. 100% of all towns, villages, and counties that put out anything in the way of their code violations, and they put their corporate cops into the streets to collect for that, all of it is null and void. They have no power and no authority to do those things. And there's no difference with the states. All of our states, probably 90% and maybe more of everything that they write is unconstitutional, null and void. Their courts don't care about the Constitution. You know, we've been looking for a long time into these things, and it becomes very clear. American jurisprudence, which is what all judges must obey in America, all judges must obey American jurisprudence, and they do not. And American jurisprudence makes it clear on what the law is. It makes it clear that the Constitution is common law, that without common law, the Constitution for the United States of America cannot be understood. Our founding fathers made it clear when they put the capstone, which is for the Constitution, which is the Bill of Rights, ten amendments, and every law that is ever written, the Constitution as a whole, anything must bear the weight of that capstone, and if it does anything to injure those ten amendments plus more, because there's a lot more than ten rights. Okay, if they did anything in any way to affect being inconsistent with that, it's null and void. But they don't care, and they do whatever it is that they want to do. And the only way they're going to stop is if you and me get out and say and make them stop. And we're doing that in the courts right now.
John.
So, yeah.
I'd like to save me some time. I want to dovetail in. I actually wanted to come in when you talked about the sheriff and said, please stop calling. But save me a little time because I have
some. Well, you can come in right now because I'm just coming to the end of that. This is what we're doing. We have if everybody gave $5 a month, we did the calculations. We have over 4,000 members. Let's say 4,000. That's $20,000 a month. No, I'm sorry. $20,000. Now, we never expected we're going to get 4,000 people giving us $5 a month, but we got half of the people. And we do have we got at least half of the people that are pretty much involved in one way or another when we look at the numbers of what we're doing, where we're going to. You know, right now we're organizing, and we were organizing the counties, and of course we had to get into the states and the districts, and we're working our way down deep into the counties. We've got all the states organized. Every state is a member of National Liberty Alliance. Every state has a unified common law grand jury within their state under all their counties. They've all went out, and they've reconstituted the common law where we the people said, yeah, we want it in a certain place in every state of the union. And we've done all this. This has been done. But now we're going out and we're going to drive down into the counties. We need leadership in every county. You see, because the way the people take control is on the grassroots, and it's all in the county. The county has everything. The county has the power. The county has the sheriff. The county has the state court. And it's all taking place in the county. And people need to be taking control of the county, four administrators in every court, in order to bring in the processes of law and virtue, which is bringing in common law grand juries, bringing in common law trial juries. This is what we the people need to be doing. Everybody needs to get involved. Every single person needs to get involved. And we need the younger kids, too. You know, we've got to get our children into this. And we're going to go out, as soon as we get into the courts and reestablish, we're going to go into the schools and we're going to revamp them. Because we the people can do what we want. This is our nation. This is our country. We the people ordained. We the people established this Constitution for them. And in the Constitution, there are lots of requirements. And Jefferson set the stage for education. We need to get back to the Jefferson education. That's what we need. And people need to understand, children coming out of grammar school, and this is not an exaggeration, children under coming out of grammar school, eighth grade, should be able to walk into any court of law and have a good enough understanding on how things work, and being able to, and a lot of them, whoever can articulate themselves well, would be able to go in and represent themselves. We used to hand out, and we have still up on our website, an eighth grade education, an eighth grade final test for the year. I think it was Kansas in 1896 or something like that. And we looked at that, and it is beyond our college education, and that's an eighth grade education. College people who graduated college couldn't even answer some of those questions or many of those questions in there. What we can teach our children, because they're teaching nothing but nonsense, how to become a good citizen and obey the government, and how to become a good communist or a Nazi. That's all they're teaching our children, how to live in a war zone under military control. They walk into their schools and they have to go through, these things, just like you do at the airport, to look for medals, to look for weapons. Okay, and they if they even confess to a problem or a situation, if they have a drug problem and they go and confess to a counselor looking for help, they'll be arrested. They'll come in and put the ties on the kid's hands, stick them behind the back, and they're arrested. What the heck are we doing? Why are we tolerating with this crap, with this garbage?
Hey, you know? John?
Only the yeah, people John? Can do it. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. I've gotten a few emails about people about the donating, and for those that don't like doing the PayPal, we have the donations that they can mail in with the address.
Oh, yeah, there's three ways on the donation page, three ways. So, yeah, they can use PayPal, and if they don't have PayPal, PayPal also has a one-time thing where they'll allow any credit card to go through. And, of course, there is also an address where you can mail a money order or a check or whatever you want to mail in that way. So there's three ways to give money. And we also, more important than money, although we do need money, don't put that too far behind, but more important is people involvement. That's what we need. We need people on our committees, people learning to write, people learning to do what has to be done to take our nation back. All right, Gerard, if you want to dovetail into that, or go right ahead.
You take cash wrapped in tinfoil, too, don't you? No, I'm
well, kidding. Don't talk about that too loud. But,
yeah. Before I lose my train of thought here, You were talking about this sheriff that we called with this court that completely ignored our habeas corpus and rode roughshod over it and went ahead and did a sale without even telling the sheriff, by the way, people. He didn't even know. It's a sheriff sale. The sheriff doesn't know what's going on. And so we need to push that sheriff to go after that judge or judges or whoever was involved and those people. Now, I want to bring something up that, we have a lot of people doing a lot of things, and we have some members that have become very capable in the statutory court because they were forced to, and they had enough education to go and learn court procedure. We have a particular person that has a case. I'm not going to name any names, but I'm going to give an example, and I'm going to give a solution to the problem, what I think is a solution. This particular person was actually a plaintiff in the court suing insurance companies, and that's the one I told you about where the lawyer for the other side said, Your Honor, you can't rule for this man, because if you do, that's going to affect all the insurance companies nationwide and through the world. And he intimidated the judge because he had made such good arguments that attorney was afraid that they were going to lose the case, and he's going for money. I don't know what the issue was or what he was suing for. It doesn't matter. But here's the deal. He took it up into the Supreme Court, the Sixth Circuit over here in New York State. He appealed it, right? So as they're going through the different processes, now he did not open a court of record because he did not know how to do that, but he knows court procedure, and he's using their statutory courts. And in the process of doing it, they put in a motion to dismiss. Now, when they put a motion to dismiss in, the other side always gets X many days to answer. And he went in impropor, and so that when you go in impropor, one of the things it does is it exempts you from electronic filing, which means you can answer in the mail, which means they got to wait those extra days for the mail. They know what it means. So he went in impropor. So they put this motion to dismiss in, and before he can even answer it, the judge did. Now, this is the Sixth Circuit. This is a three-panel judge. You see, John, this is why I can't believe. Look, you could say that one judge was stupid or you overlooked something or something, but you got three judges on a panel that violate the due process rights of this fella, right? How do three judges violate due process and not know what they're doing? And if that's the case, it's pretty damn bad, right? So now they told him you got 14 days you can answer this thing. That, you know, he can protest the dismissal or ask for a rehearing. Whatever you do when you pray in these statutory courts, I don't know. I don't care. Fact of the matter is, it's pretty bad when the Sixth Circuit three judges violate due process. Now, this has nothing even to do with the case. This is due process. This is what we're going after in our habeas corpus. This is how we're kicking their asses, is through due process. That's what they're doing to people. And here's a blatant example of three judges on a panel falling down on due process. Now, I know this is not somebody losing their kids or anything, but this is in the Supreme Court of the United States in the Sixth Circuit in New York. Now, I don't know who those three judges are, but let me tell you something. You want to hold these people's feet to the fire? We should find the name of those judges out. That's another phone thing we should be doing. We should be putting their names up in light, saying these judges on the Sixth Circuit, and that's an excuse for the common law grand jury to go in there and say, you guys are out of control. That gives us the excuse to come in and say, okay, now you did it. We're indicting you. We're going to indict you. You know, this is so blatant, their own people should come down after them. Three judges granting a dismissal before the time is even up before to answer? It's a blatant abuse of power and a violation of due process. So there, like we did with this sheriff and some of the other victories we had people calling. We should call these judges out. We should put their names up in lights. They should be going crazy. We should be calling their offices. And, I mean, this is not even a major thing for us. But the major thing is the fact that they're sitting on a federal bench. What does it mean when three judges make the same? Are they all stupid or are they all in collusion? It's a proof of conspiracy. And RICO, he's fighting corporations. You can't let this guy win because it'll affect all the insurance companies. So you make a good argument, but they're going to say, no, you can't do it because it's going to affect us, the corporation. You know, as far as they're concerned, they've deluded themselves into believing that something like that's a national security. Oh, well, if the insurance companies go out of business, then this company will go out of business, and we'll have this domino effect. Whatever they think in their sick minds to give them the excuse to break the law on due process on somebody that's made a good argument in a statutory court. Now, it's going to be very hard for him to fix his case and go back and do a court of record because he's already done all this stuff. He's already in their court. But look at this guy has been in there, and they violated his due process. Right there is where he gets back into common law. And I just want to, you know, this is one of the ways that we could take our battles into the court and target these people. And I don't remember, but I seem to remember. I'm not sure, but I thought that the Sixth Circuit Court was one of them. Now, I don't know if it was on the federal or state, John, but one of them had most of their. It might have been the New York Sixth Circuit.
Yeah, it had to be. It had to be New York state courts because in a federal district, they're called district courts, and there are four of them in New York, and that's it. Mm-hmm. But
well, one of them, I think the Sixth Circuit in New York has makes the worst decisions, gets overturned the most. Now, this guy is in the, I don't know, this is not the same, this is a federal court, and it's the Sixth Circuit. So I don't know if that's the same court that I heard makes all these bad decisions. But this is another thing.
Well, they all make bad decisions, so I think they got one thing that's in common with all of them, you know.
Wait a minute. Anyway, that's what I wanted to focus in on, because it kind of goes in with the process that we're doing and the bringing the sheriffs in. And part of that process is like when we call, look at in the Dean case, we call the courts, we call the judge, we call everybody. That's how you knock them off balance and let them know the people are coming out. They have to see the people. You see, I'm hoping, and I get discouraged because look at, here's three judges on a panel and they're all no good. I mean, look at, they're either. It's like I told my congressman, I said, look, you're either a toddler behind the wheel of a car or you're a homicidal maniac, but you don't belong driving that car, whatever the case may be. If you're that ignorant, you don't belong there. And if you're not ignorant, then you're doing it with full forethought and malice. So we have to, this is how we need to deal with this stuff and shine lights on this stuff. Here's three judges on a panel that made a due process error. I told them to go ahead and sign up with our crew, and maybe they could do some kind of a habeas corpus with his due process, or even to just address it, you know, as the grand jury coming in and telling these guys that you violated the due process rights, and that's what we're about. And as we raise our heads up and they see us, you're going to see that those judges that understand that the system is broken, like that one judge that said all the administrative courts of the United States are unconstitutional, something made that judge do that. And I believe it's because, I think it was a woman, she looked out and she saw that there's people making claims. She saw that the time was right, that she could actually open her mouth without maybe being killed by sundown. You know what I mean? So I think we have momentum going with us at this point. And I think things like this we need to get on them. This is the type of stuff that we can do as court watchers, you know. But it's all about this organization. You see, if we're not organized, we can't get the calls out to the right judges, the right places, the right people. Look, we need to be a well-oiled machine. Those guys should get, you know, 50, 100 calls, and it's a short period of time, within a week or two. You know what I mean? Everybody calling. An indictment or some kind of paper going in there, calling them on the carpet. What do you think you're doing? Violating due process. You didn't even wait for the answer. You know, I don't know if he should put in and complain and give them a chance to fix the thing they did before we go after them. But I think it's a ripe one for the grand jury. Anyway, I'm going to yield, John. I just wanted to get that out there.
Go ahead. Thank you. Yeah, courtroom observers. That's, we're going to get very, very active, as most everyone should know, that we have a committee called courtroom observers to assist people in the courts, to go to courts, to bear witness, to write affidavits on their behalf. And again, as I mentioned, we are the most organized and active group, and I don't want to call us a group, assembly of people, than any other liberty group in America. You know, some liberty groups might be larger than us, but they're not as active as us, and none of them are doing what we're doing. We are getting the people involved. We're teaching and training the people to get up and do the job, and not everybody behind one or two or three or 10 people that are doing the job, because you're never going to win back America that way. The people have to get up. The people have to do it. And so we're very, very close. We're working on some, bringing some the hammer of justice down on a couple of people, and particularly a couple of judges and prosecutors out in Utah. Okay, we've already made a decision on that. It just has to be executed. When we do that, we're going to probably request people to start calling certain places to make sure that things happen. We're going to make connection with the sheriff out there before we file our paperwork to make sure he understands the law and his duty, and spend as much time as we have to with him until he understands, well, okay, here it is. It's your job. Now you've been enlightened. Now you have knowledge. Now you have to act and do what has to be done. And if you refuse to act, then you become part of the crime. And it's called felony rescue. And then you become part of the conspiracy, and we'll be looking for your arrest as well as we'll be looking for others. Now, we don't want to work with sheriffs with the threat, so we'll probably leave that part out. But that's what we will be doing, though, if the sheriff denies his job and refuses to do his duty. He doesn't need the approval of the judge and he doesn't need the approval of the prosecutor. For if he needs them, then we should have elected the judge or the prosecutor as sheriff, because we certainly don't need him then. We also, you know, working in other places, we're going to need, once we train and teach the sheriff out in, because he's going to have to do some things out in Long Island concerning the case we have going. We have an individual who is a lawyer, who is also the person who was supposed to be selling off the property. The whole thing was a sham, a con. They didn't even do what they said they were going to do. They were purposely 2 hours late. There was no one there to bid off to, so they bid to themselves, and they bought the property themselves. The whole thing was a sham. And but nevertheless, it's a lawyer firm, and they snubbed their nose at us. They did write a letter. We got some things we're going to be doing with them. But we're expecting those people to be arrested by the sheriff for contempt of court. And also we're expecting also to fine them for contempt of court. We're going to do judicial oversight on the judge, the chief judge that was given the authority and a process out of New York City, I think it was in Brooklyn, in order to oversight this case, and they haven't done it. So now we're going to start to push that individual. They've got to get more active. Also, you know, with the sheriff. So all these people that we're talking about, particularly the chief judge and also the sheriff, when we start pushing on these people and putting the letters in and starting to make the phone calls to have dialogue with them, that's when we need we, the people from across America, to be making those phone calls, get active, the courtroom observers. Everybody is a courtroom observer. Everybody should drop the dime and make the call and let them know we're watching. We want justice back in our courts. We know what's going on. You know, let them know. We'll lay out a whole list of different things people can talk about when they call these people. So we're going to become very active. And as I mentioned, we have somewhere between 100 and 150 cases coming up of habeas corpuses. And each one of them, we want them to be followed up with phone calls and want to start pushing these people and letting them know, see, this is how we're going to get into the courts. Now, there's other things happening also that we don't talk about, and anything can happen at any time, and a whole landslide across America could take place, and the people finally will wake up. But, you know, we don't know when that's going to happen, but it will come. That is going to come. And we believe it will be National Liberty Alliance, the work of the people, the members of National Liberty Alliance, as they come to assemble to take back their nation, for we the people did ordain and establish this for them. Now they have to obey it. And it's going to be because of the work we're doing, which will save America and cause that landslide to get into the courts. And when we take back the courts, we take back America 100%. You know, as Rothschild said, you know, give me control of the people's money, and I don't care who makes the laws. Well, he lied about that. Because, you see, he can have control of the money, and he can have control of even the people who make the laws if he wants. He can have control of the administration, and they do, okay? But if they don't have control of the courts, all of that is meaningless, because courts will bring justice down upon those people who are coming in with these subversive actions. And so, you know, we have to get active. We got to do what we got to do. We got to respond to the call. We got to pay attention. We got to be coming to these Monday night meetings and learn what's going on and see the latest. A quick thing, you know, we're working diligently on the CPS projects, you know, getting all these cases in the courts. We are running behind on that. I really didn't think we would, but we are. So we're doing our best to get that out. But the most important thing that we the people need to do before we can have any results, before we can have any victory, before we could do anything and put anything as we think is justice into the courts, the most important thing we need to do is to know the king. And you could do that in the silence of your own home and just talk to him. Okay, with that, I guess we'll move over to, does anybody else have an announcement or anything before we move into an open forum here?
I have questions.
Ahead. Ooh, yeah. You got questions.
Well, it's
people mailed in questions?
Yeah, these are mailed in questions, and this is a recurring question, so I don't want to ask this one specifically, and I don't think you want to answer it specifically. It's that this individual has gotten a speeding ticket. It's they can't afford the ticket, and they've heard about our habeas corpuses, and they're wanting to seek, you know, remedy.
Only if they're facing jail will we get involved in that kind of thing. I mean, we'd like to get involved in all of it, but then we wouldn't be able to get anything done. And the people that are losing their children, losing their homes, losing their liberty, they're going to fall away if we start taking on those kind of cases. But look at, you know, if you can't, you have to pick your battles to begin with. Okay, and even if if you can't afford to pay it, you know, if you kiss the rear end of the court, they're so happy with that to begin with, and you say, hey, look, I'm almost destitute. I can only give you maybe $30-$40 a month, and you know they'll work that deal out with you. Trust me, because they want the money, and they want a returning customer too, you know, a good paying returning customer, and they'll see you as that too. Now, the only other way you could deal with that is learn how to fight in the courts, and we don't teach that here per se. We do kind of teach all that, but we don't. We don't teach that particular part of the process. But if you take up a civics course, you start reading court access, how to get in, you learn how to write your papers, you learn the strategies, you understand jurisdiction, then you'll know exactly what you're doing, how to get out of that court and move yourself over into another court where they can't operate and the whole thing just goes away. But that's an education. And if people aren't willing to take the education, you know, if you make things simple for people, what is that old saying? You know, if you give a fish to a hungry man, he's going to be hungry tomorrow. But if you teach him how to fish, he'll have enough fish for a lifetime. And so that's what National Liberty Alliance's position is we're going to teach you how to fish. And if you want fish, because you need fish to eat, then we're going to teach you. And that's going to take time. Meanwhile, between now and then, you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. Do the best you can. I never give a cop a hard time, ever, never, never. I even thank them when they leave my vehicle. Thank you very much. But usually, 50% of the time, they don't even give me a ticket. The other 50% of the time, I'll do a paperwork, and I might get 50% of that time, I might get thrown out of the court with my paperwork. Because they just don't want to bother me. The other 50% aren't paying attention. They pull me in. So what I do is try to work a deal out with the cop and pay the ticket. And if the cop ain't there, then I'll move the court to to throw it out because he's not there. And usually they will. Okay. So you have to play it by ear. You have to pick your battles. Bill Fortin teaches that. I agree with him, so we teach it too. Pick your battles where you're going to fight. You want to learn. The perfect place to learn is in traffic court. But at some point, don't get yourself lost and getting hurt by being under contempt of court. Don't treat them disrespectfully because they will put you in jail. And just see what you could do and where you can get it to, and at least you'll get some experience. But unless you know how to do it, you're going to end up paying the fine. So anyway.
All right. Well, here's a tough one. I don't know why anybody would consider this low-hanging fruit, but do we intend on going after the Federal Reserve?
What we're doing will take care of that on its own. We don't need to discuss that directly. So. Anything else?
No, I think we can move on.
Okay. It's not wise to discuss that directly. Just think about it. So.
Oh, you got that anyway. Right.
Okay, so let's open
Kennedy it up. Discussed it.
yeah. Let's open it up to Q&A. Don't anyone get into anybody who has a case going with us and would like to ask a question or something can get into the queue. CPS questions particularly, where we're at with that, those kind of things. So let's give those people 15 seconds or so to get into the queue. Anybody who is new to National Liberty Alliance and would like to ask a question, never been here before. Anybody that's been around for a while or new or whatever and never asked a question before, let them get into the queue if they're interested. Anybody who's been trying to get into the queue for the past couple of weeks or so, let them get into the queue. So we'll give them another 5 or 10 seconds for all those particular groups of people to get into the queue, and then we'll open it up to everyone else. So we'll take our first caller.
John, I think you need to flush the queue. I mean, because we've already got people at the top. I don't know if they're.
Well, they know what they. I saw them coming in as I was telling them, so
all right.
They should hopefully obey the rules. All right, let's go to the first caller, David. It looks like go right ahead, David. And by the way, Gerard, I'm going to have to disappear for about a half hour or so very shortly. Are you going to be around?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to pass it to you in a few minutes anyway, and then I'll be back in a half hour. Go ahead. But anyway, David, go right ahead.
John, this is Dave Wisher. I'm in Missouri. I want to ask you a quick question. I was Googling the IRS to see what information I could find, and I ran across somebody by the name of M.R. Hamilton, and he has got an article out that says, you don't have to pay your income tax because it's not a law. And he refers to U.S. State Code Title 26, Section 7806. Have you ever heard of it?
Oh, yeah. We're very familiar with that, where it says very clearly that that U.S. Title 26 is not law. We know about that. We have used that. It by itself will get you a jail sentence. So, you know, I mean, look, if they're coming out to put you in jail, they'll get you a jail sentence. Look, if they're coming out to get you to put you in jail, they're going to put you in jail. Very few people are able to escape that. But if you have to fight them and you're fighting them, of course, that is part of the ammunition. U.S. 26, I forget the number, whatever number you said, and you want to bring that up. Also, Form 56 and Form 4490, both those forms need to be filed in the federal court where you live. And those are sworn affidavit forms that have to be filled out by the individuals coming out to take your money. They never do that. Also, the sheriff and the county freezes your assets on behalf of them. That's lack of due process. That's another problem. You have to bring all these issues up, and you bring them to a head, and you have to be real hardcore with them and keep pushing on the paperwork. And they have to really kind of get to be worried about who you are and what you're doing. And that judge, that federal judge, will maybe start to feel that that maybe he's at risk here. So maybe this case needs to be settled, and he'll push for a settlement. It's rare that happens, but that's the way you could beat it. The other way, if you actually pulled into the court itself, is to do habeas corpus. And the grand jury is more than welcome to do it for anybody who needs it. If you're in a jurisdiction where you don't belong, and clearly U.S. The 26 courts, which they actually rent the rooms of the federal court district courts. They rent the rooms, and they also hire out, they contract out the federal judges. And that's in addition to their normal job and a normal salary. And most of these judges I have heard get a minimum of $30,000 a case for every case that they get a conviction of. They may have to pay them if they don't get a conviction. But in any event, they're $30,000 and more for every case they get a conviction. That's what I heard, and they make no, they don't shy away from that. You'll read it in different places where they do get a big nut of money for every case that they convict. So it's a tough battle to make against those people, and you know, if you've been paying taxes and going along with the game, I'd say continue for a while until we the people get in. If you're already fighting them, do the best you can. And if you're in their courts, do a habeas corpus through us, and we'll get you out of the courts. And that's the best we can do.
Okay. I didn't like your opinion there. And I have joined your Bible study, by the way, and I think you're doing a great job. And God bless.
Appreciate it. Yeah, Godspeed to you, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's take a VoIP caller. Hey, by the way, Gary, is there any way to go in through the callers' names and wherever you see a VoIP caller to click on their name and to try to take away that Don name? Now,
no.
You may have to wait for the original. Well, I don't know. There may be only one Don that comes in that might be blackened.
I tried it when the first Don clicked in like a week or two ago, and it's hardened. It's not editable.
Okay, you know what we want to do then? We want to make a call, you know, call up the tech number up on the top. They're 24 hours, 24/7, so maybe that's something you could do when you get a chance. And tell them of our problem coming in through the VoIP caller through the browser, and that everyone is called Don.
Is that through our provider?
Oh, yeah. These people right here, HT, they'll help you out on that. What happened was you had a VoIP dialer come in. They didn't have a name. You were able to click on it. You give them a name, and it stuck, okay? And everybody that comes in as a VoIP caller is called Don. And I think even if they put their own name in their state, a name and state, their first name and state, they still come in as Don.
Yeah.
So let's see if we can fix that and be careful not to hit any VoIP dialer again. It doesn't have a name. We can't give them a name. Okay. Next, we're going to take Don, VoIP, a VoIP caller. Don, well, VoIP, VoIP dialer, go right ahead.
Is
coming
in
off the browser. That's you.
That's me. That's Jan. How are you?
How you doing, Jan?
I have a question. Thank you. I got a habeas corpus coming up, but in my case, someone says to slow the case down, do a notice of intent to appeal.
Yeah, that's a good way. That's a good thing to do. That freezes everything up. You see, once you go in, if they're coming to the end, you can do a notice of attempt to, notice of intent to appeal, and you can get quite a few months off of that. I think they give you, here in New York, they give you up, I think, 8 months, because we've done that before. You got 8 months to actually file your paperwork, but it freezes up everything that they've done.
So I got coming up a motion to compel, and they want the discovery to compel
right,
the discovery.
Let me give you a little story, and for those people who know how to work the court's procedures and how to write papers and do it the right way, then that's through mostly the way Bill Thornton has taught, opening up a court of record. Let me give you a little nugget that we had learned, and every case is a default case. Every case. And by the way, I'm feeding back to someone. Who am I feeding back to? I'm feeding back to you, Gary.
I'll stop that.
Okay, yeah, stop that.
Can you repeat that? Every case what?
Every case that they do is a default case. And let me give you an example. It may not happen to you this way, but it'll usually happen to you. If you're coming into a court, especially if you're initiating it, okay? And when you write your papers, they have to answer. And I remember the very first time we went into court, they had 30 days to answer. We knew they were down to like 28, 27. They had filed a motion to dismiss, a motion to strike, and all this other BS stuff. We came into the courts, and they had two more days to respond. They had not responded yet. So this was day 28. And we finally came into the court, and there was a hearing on to decide on this decision to throw out our case. Now, it was clear to us they were going to throw out our case, but we had so many people show up, the judge got frightened, and they had double defaulted on the other side, and we went through all these things. And this was the second part of that case, if I recall. But in any event, they decided that he was going to let the case go forward. He found for us, but he was going to give them more time. And I says, well, okay, yeah, that's fine, giving them more time to answer what's going on here, because they were going to do a default on us, or for our behalf, they actually defaulted. But I said, you know what? They never answered our papers, and they got two more days, and we're expecting to get that answer. And the judge says, oh, no, they got 30 days now. And I said, well, how do we get to that? I forget exactly how the dialogue went, but the bottom line is this, that they had given them 30, they had on the 28th day, because they filed a notice, a motion to dismiss, when they got into the court, they accepted that motion to dismiss to freeze everything until the decision was made, and then they restarted the clock again for them responding. And that's the game they play. But you know what? They can play whatever game they want. Whenever you get anything that prevents them, when they come in and they don't answer, even if they come in and they dismiss the case, what you do is you go through the Thornton tapes and learn how to do this process. Make sure you have your seal. Make sure you understand how to write the papers. Open up a court of record. Take control of the court. You got to get a court on top of that court if they've come out after you, or if you come out after them, you're on top of the court anyway. And then you have to steamroll them. You turn around and you do a writ of error. Now remember, the judge has to rule according to American jurisprudence, and they don't. So get to know. We've got some information on American jurisprudence, some of the most powerful stuff, and we haven't posted that up online. We will, but there's a lot of stuff just in the 10 pages or so we have a lot of stuff that we can utilize to show that the judge doesn't have the authority to do certain things. And certainly he doesn't have the authority or the ability to make a decision in the court, especially if you open the court of record, because you're expecting a jury. and they can't dismiss witnesses, they can't seal things up, they can't throw things out, they can't make motion, rule on motion, they can't do any of those things, okay? But they do. And since it's an error, and you can pull out of jurisprudence, or which works off of mostly other United States Supreme Court rulings, so there's lots of them out there, you could pull that stuff into the court, use that to show that this judge is in error, overrule him, and take away that authority and bring the court back to its place. Then, in our case, we could have waited another 2 days, and then we could have turned around, filed for a default, okay, with the clerk, and as long as we got a good wherefore clause, we would get what we're looking for in the court. When we do an affidavit, you file for a default that they never answered, and you do that with it's a one-page default paper and an affidavit attached. And then once you get that default paper filed in, you take that, and you serve it on to the sheriff and go collect your wherefore clause. Now, this is something you could do with pretty much any case out there, if you really think about it. Now, they're going to moan and complain about it, but if you don't steamroll them, they'll find a way to offset that. You got to move quick enough. We did do one case without realizing, and we moved very quickly on it, and we got one case, and the judge said he was going to make a ruling, and we told him he couldn't, but he was going to make a ruling anyway, and he never did, okay? And the default seems to have stuck, and nobody has bothered anyone, and nothing has happened in the courts, and everything is just shut down. So we did it once, and it worked out, and again, we didn't realize how powerful that move was. But this works pretty much in every court case. They never look at if they answer your complaint, and they do it through the lawyer, and the lawyer says, well, okay, I'm talking on behalf of the individual, so they're really doing an affirmation on behalf of the client. Well, that's secondhand information. That person's he's not a witness. And it doesn't matter that his client signed a paper saying that, yeah, that's good, that's true. First of all, there wasn't a sworn affidavit to say that was true to begin with. And second of all, saying what someone else is true is also secondhand information. The point is there's no affidavit in the court. And this is a way they use to make it look like there's an affidavit and there isn't. Police reports do this all the time. On the bottom it says, I solemnly swear that all the contents is true, blah, 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 and the police officer signs it, but there's no stamp, no witness. And the only people that can witness is a notary public, a magistrate, and a judge. I'm not aware of anybody else. Those are the three in a court. And so if they don't have that, there is no sworn affidavit. So you don't have a real sworn affidavit for a police report. You don't have a sworn affidavit for a client or an individual that never really did an affidavit directly, didn't deny or accept anything you said. Lawyers always deny, accept, or whatever. They do all this stuff and they play their games and they lie in it. And they can't hold the client liable because they never made the sworn affidavit. And actually what they were doing is really acting on behalf, and they've got a clause that they're not held liable. And it's all a game they play. And they acknowledge and help each other. And they just come into court and lie. And no sworn affidavits. There is no case. What makes a prima, there's only one thing that makes a prima facie case of law. One thing and one thing only. And that's a sworn affidavit. If there is no sworn affidavit, there is no case. You can have a contract, and you can argue the contract, but if no one swears an affidavit concerning that contract, they shouldn't even be in court. Go home, because there's nothing to discuss. You have to put your word on the line and swear to it. And if you don't do that, there is no case. And they never swear to anything. So right there is a default on every single case out there. So anybody who understands how to write papers, do it correctly, and you can use that strategy. Anything else? We're going to move on.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll go to the next caller. Thank you. All right, next person is a 518 number, 382.
Hi, John. Jeff Gall here.
Hey, Mr. Jeff. How you doing?
Good, good. Hey, first of all, I didn't intend to ask this, but I just want to bring this up and perhaps for responses later on. I don't want to diminish my points, but I never heard of a notice of intent to appeal in New York State.
Yeah, I did that when I went up to the courts. We went to the appellate or the appeals court, and when we spoke to the people, we got the papers and everything. We were just learning way back then. And and it was, they put it very clearly to us that once you fill this out, which is an intent to go in, you got so many days to actually get the paper in, and that gives you 8 months, okay? 8 months to be able to. You got to do it within 30 days, though. You have to file your paper, your intent to yep. appeal
okay.
right there. But you have to go up to the appellate court to do that.
That's the third department, though. Okay, so that may be
Melbourne
something
Albany,
that,
yeah.
Yeah, that might be something they allow. I just, you know, I just wasn't aware of it as a general thing. Okay, listen, I think this is appropriate, but if it's not, please let me know. I mean, I tried to listen to everything you're saying, before you opened it up. It's an open mic kind of a scenario now, correct or not?
Yeah, questions,
okay.
answers, and also comments.
Okay, well, I had a $600 case. I'm a defendant. And a court reporting company tried to basically make me buy transcripts from a case. I did depositions. The plaintiff
well,
hired
try to
them.
Talk. Try to talk in general terms, so we don't have to talk about a particular case, but just
right.
generally speaking.
No. Oh, okay. Okay. Well. Okay. So here's my general thing. Then I mean, I went to a jury. I demanded a jury trial, and the judge. Created what he called a verdict sheet, which is the most mind-blowing thing I've ever seen in my life. And I mean, he posed three questions to the jury that, you know, it's clear that, you know, his intention was to screw me. you know.
Well, you got
so,
a copy of that sheet?
Yes. Yes.
Well, any jury tampering, go to federal courts. That's a federal offense. It's a federal case. Anytime they violate your right of due process, jury tampering is violating your due process, especially by the judge. Forget about it. That's a federal case. File
right.
it there and sue them all.
Well, okay, so how do I do that?
Well, first of all, you got to realize you can't pay the $400. Federal case costs $400 to open it. One of the few places we went to where we didn't have a hard time was right up there in Albany. And we went up to the federal courts and filed the federal case. And I went in there. I had what's called a file and demand with me. I just gave the papers out. She wanted money. I said, no, we don't pay money with the people. You know, justice cannot be charged. And then we give them the... a file and demand, and she studied that for, you know, a minute or so and looked at that and said, okay. And she started to pull all the paperwork together, and then she says, okay, you're going to have to fill out this form here. I said, no, we don't do any of that. We're the people. We don't pay for justice, and there is a Supreme Court ruling. It's a file and demand. You have to do your job as the clerk and let the judge worry about anything else. And she looked at that, read some more, and she went over to a desk and started doing some work in a computer and then pulling papers together, and then came over and stamped the papers and gave us the copy of the file and the number, and we got in without a problem. Down in New York City, I had a different problem. I filed the paper down in New York City. They returned my papers. So I said, okay, fine. So I filed another complaint. I filed another case. I filed this two cases now. I sent the first case back under cover of the second case, the new case, which named the clerk who denied the process without the money for denying my due process rights as protected by the Fifth Amendment. Immediately, I got everything back stamped and approved and everything. They never sent the second paper back down to me, but the original paper, they stamped, approved, and got it into the system. So that's how you do it. You got to put their neck into the game, you know, their skin into the game. But if you pay that $400, guess what you paid for? You paid for a chancery court to go into their court where the judge is the king and he's going to make the decision and you're going to lose.
Right.
So the first, you have to start right off the bat refusing to pay. I'm not even going to pay for state courts anymore. I'm just going to refuse to pay, and I'll do the same thing. I'll sue the clerk that prevents the paperwork from going in, and I'll sue the judge if we have to. And I'll sue them in federal court. They have no control over the federal court. You
right.
see, once they deny you due process in any way, shape, or form, that becomes a federal case. You know, go to the Constitution and read under the Article 3. It tells you, I think it's in Section 4, Article 3, 4, I think, where you will read what the cases that fall under the federal courts are. And any case that falls under the Constitution or the laws of the United States of America is a federal case. And that included, of course, the capstone Bill of Rights. So anytime they violate your unalienable right of due process. And that's what they do every day, all day. The moment you walk in, they violated you by moving you into a foreign court. There, and they violated your right of due process. You only have to tell them once, or just ask them once, what court are we in? Are we in a court of equity? Are we in a court of law? A court of equity operating under the rules of chancery, or we're in a court of law? Because I don't understand what we're doing here for this hearing, because in a court of law, there are no hearings. So, and of course, they won't answer. And remember, when they refuse to answer, when they have duty to answer, the Supreme Court has ruled numerous times, that's fraud. Okay, so right there's fraud on the court to begin with. Refusing to answer tells you that you're in the wrong court. The fact that they steamroll you and continue to go, even though you object to the process because you're not getting your due process through a court of law, and they steamroll you anyway in, you got everything you need to go into a federal court. So every state court, every town court, every village court, every city court, every court which is violating your right of due process, you can pull them all into federal court. And you'll get more clout and pressure in a federal court than you will in any other court. And they do have a little bit of fear with people who know what they're doing up there. So you have to fake it and make it look like you know what you're doing.
Do we have any successes in the Albany federal court?
We didn't have any success in the Albany court or any of those. We've had successes in the federal court down in New York City. We haven't been into too many federal courts, but that's the process we use.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Okay. Oh, well, let me take that back. No, we are in a lot of federal courts. We are in all 94 federal courts with our paperwork, and they are bone silence, nothing, absolutely nothing, just quiet, okay?
Right.
So what does that mean? That means fraud, doesn't it?
Right.
And we filed 10 papers. We've been in there since, I think, March of this year. We have our own number, and every paper has been filed. Nothing has been returned on the federal level. Okay, in all 94 courts. And we've copied all the people involved, all 12,500 elected individuals on the state and federal levels. So everybody knows we're there, and they know what we're doing. And we've seen the response of one judge saying that we were sovereign citizens, dangerous to society and to one thing, and by the time he comes 20 days later back in the court, we're good citizens, good concerned citizens. He changed his words because he was fear of indictment, which he was too late, and we did indict him. We just haven't applied it yet. But anyway. Okay, Jeff. I guess Jeff is gone. Did Jeff leave us? Hey, Gerard, you want to take over? I don't know if Trevor has been... Trevor, can you hear us? Peter. Okay. You're going to have to hit the next button. I didn't do it, so... I'll be back in a short while, and I'll listen in the back when I come back, okay? You got it?
Hello?
Yeah, Peter, you got the mic.
This is Steve. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, go ahead, Steve. We have you down as Trevor Peter, so you might be on someone else's.
Oh, it's, okay. So it's Stephen Peter from Utah.
Oh, okay. Gerard, you got
Utah.
This?
Yeah, I do.
I don't hear you, Gerard.
I'm here.
I heard
can you hear
very
me?
Faintly. You're getting better. Go ahead.
Really?
Okay.
You're good now.
Okay. I've got my daughter's going through some problems. She's in court, and... We gave them a notice of demand on jurisdiction, and they pretty much just forgot, just blew right out of the water. And then the county attorney said he wanted to have her post bail at the preliminary when she's already posted bail when she was arrested for the first time. And I'm not quite understanding how they can get away with that. Any insight on that?
Well, I don't. I mean, how did they post bail? In other words, she posted bail at the indictment, right?
No, she was arrested, and then was posted bail to get out of jail.
So
the preliminary. Well, we went to her first appearance, and which in which we handed them a notice of demand, and Then the county attorney at that point said that he would require bail from her at the preliminary when they scheduled the preliminary hearing, because they didn't even, the notice of demand didn't even really do much at all. Just kind of just, they just thumbed their noses at it.
Well, I'm not sure, but I look at, they're doing it, they're turning everything on its head. First of all, they're supposed, that preliminary hearing is supposed to be for you to defend yourself against an indictment. That's what the purpose of it is. So anything they do, they're really not supposed to do anything before that. So I don't know. You went in front of a judge and you had bail. That should be the bail for the case. I don't know how he can. I don't know how he can come back and say he wants her to post additional bail. I mean, did
by the way, we have two cases floating around with that same kind of a situation where bail kept going up three times. I mean, they're just out of control, is what it is.
Yeah, they're not supposed to make cruel or unreasonable bail, and there's actually codes for, you know, you may want to go in and make that claim and put that code that this is you know, I forget the specific term of the code when they put the unreasonable.
Would that be putting her in twice or jeopardy twice?
Incarcerated. Bail. Time. What did she do? She put a bond up, right?
Well, right.
Money up for a bond. Well, she didn't get her money back, did she?
No, they're still retaining that.
Right. So she's got bail posted. She didn't violate it. She showed up. Right.
Yeah, so she hasn't violated it.
How do they figure they should get more bail?
I do not know. It was just their answer to the notice of demand that she handed the county attorney.
They're trying to punish you, that's why. Because you gave them a notice of demand. You gave them something they're not used to. They said, wise guy.
Yeah, she said that they were trying to stall the court.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what the particular situation here is, but, you know, there's things you can do at this juncture to stall them. Like John says, put in your intent to appear or whatever, and get yourself time to figure out what's going on. Now, you know, if you really ticked off the TA, he may be trying to go get so she gets put in jail. I've seen that too, where they work real hard just to let your butt sit in jail to make you more compliant when you come back in. You know what I mean? I mean, he already knows he's going to fight because you put a notice of demand in, you know?
Yeah, well, right, exactly. She said she'd already told that she's going pro se. So, I mean, if they put her in jail, she's not able to, you know, do anything, any work on her case whatsoever.
Yeah, that's bad. Well, I don't want to get into some specifics of the case because this is not for that. But let me tell you what, if it looks like they're going to try to put her in jail, she needs to go and apply to our team there for a habeas corpus. You know what I mean? Try to get her out of that.
Yeah, well, she's a member. She signed on with us. You know, I mean, I've gone through my my course already, my civics course. I've completed that, and I've just got to try to have some tough times right now. I'm trying to keep her out.
She may want to go ahead and do an intake with us anyway, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't, you know, not pay attention to the case. You need to file some stuff. You need to stall for some time. I don't know what your particulars are, but you see
the prelim scheduled for the 18th. You know,
the what?
The preliminaries is coming on the 18th this month already.
Right, and you know, they rushed right into that. You know, look at, if they post bail before the preliminary, I think that's normal, because if they pick you up off the street. They're supposed to do the preliminary hearing within so many hours or days or something, and a lot of times they don't do it. They violate it.
Well, it's the first appearance, and then in the first appearance, and then they schedule your preliminary. Until they do it here.
Appearance is when the cop pulls you off the road and wakes up the magistrate at night, and he gives you your bail. That's your first appearance, right?
Well, when she was in jail, that her first appearance was just when they set the bell. She didn't have to see a judge. The bell was just set. She just had to come up with the...
Right. So what happens at the preliminary
10% of the bond.
Right. Now, here's the deal. At the preliminary hearing, you have a right to defend yourself against the charges that you shouldn't be indicted against in the first place. So, I mean, if she's got a good case, she should present the case and say, do it in such a tone that they're attacking her under tone of law without getting nasty, letting all the police officers and the judges and everybody know that she's going to hold them responsible for acting under color of law. Look, she could get a slam dunk at that preliminary hearing. If she puts a good show on and she could talk real well, they think she knows what she's doing, that judge may want to get rid of her, and he has an opportunity to kill the case at the preliminary hearing. I don't, without knowing any of the particulars of the case, I mean, if you have a cop or a DA that's really hot on having her prosecuted, if it's not just a simple, you know, case where they picked her up willy-nilly, if there's history there, they're going to give you trouble. But you can win in a preliminary hearing, and you can get it thrown out. And a lot of times, if they think it's going to be a trouble, that's a victory. They'll throw the case out. So don't. You know, make sure you do a good showing at that preliminary hearing, and let her argue. If she's innocent, and let her bring it up, and let her make the charges or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that is an opportunity. And look, he can. I do believe at that time he can change the bail, because the first time you came in under the arrest, under the officer, and they just want a guarantee that you're going to show up. And if you have, they have certain guidelines. If you have no priors, it depends on what it is. If it's not a murder, okay, no priors, no this. It's like you put the IBM card in and it shoots the result out. That's how she got her first bail. She got what I like to call the IBM card system. It went in, all the dots lined up, and they said, okay, pay this. That's just a guarantee to get her to that preliminary hearing. Now, once the preliminary hearing comes, that's when more of the facts of the case come out. That case can be dismissed at the preliminary hearing. They don't usually do that, but if they botch something really bad, that's an opportunity for everybody to reset and run. So I would try to do a really good presentment at the preliminary hearing where that you make them know in no uncertain terms that you're going to hold their feet to the fire for violating you if that's what they're doing. You know what I mean? And see, once he gets the facts of the case, now the DA gets to argue for the bail. He can raise it, he can lower it, he can do whatever he wants, right?
Well, the basis on the case is just going to be a constitutional, you know, her jurisdiction. I mean, she's got to possess some possessions on illegal search and seizure, and I mean, she's flat out framed. I mean, straight up framed on that stuff. I'm totally convinced of that.
She needs to bring up all the arguments at that preliminary hearing. If she has problems that are violations of her unalienable rights, she needs to bring them up, and she needs to let them know that she intends to seek a redress in the federal court. That this is fruits from the poison tree. And they understand what that is. So if they have fruits of a poison tree, and the Supreme Court understands what that is, and it happens all the time, and you'll probably want to use that term, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I present it there. Now, I don't know what's going to happen, but that's where you're at right now. That's what you need to focus on.
Okay. You know what I mean? All right.
I mean, where you go after that is going to be the results of that. There's no sense in talking about it, because until you get through that preliminary hearing. Look at if you do a real good job at the preliminary hearing, and the judge and they don't want to mess with you, and they think that you're going to cause trouble, and they got enough crap going on in their lives already, they may let her go.
Right.
All right.
All right. Well, thanks for your time and your advice. I appreciate it. And God bless you all. And
thank you very much.
Let somebody else get on here. Okay.
I'm going to move to the next caller, which is a no name, and the last four numbers 9126, you are unmuted. Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, yeah. We have a case, John mentioned, Don Jobson. Don, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. We'd like to pretty much know what the status of that is. We just sent back the affidavit, which was notarized, and we just want to check up on the timeline of when we can expect the not corpus selecti, but the
You're in while our intake, and you sent back your affidavit. Is that what you're saying? That you filed with our intake crew?
Right.
You
want to
know
right.
how long the case will take? I can't even tell you because I have nothing to do with that. You're gonna. I don't know who took you in, but you.
John's working on that.
Oh well, right now he's gone for a half hour, so I'm taking over. But John, if John's doing it personally, I know that he is busy, but he's working on it. So I'm not going to give you a time frame, but I know that it's in the till, and you know
right.
John works when he can work, and he sometimes he does a massive amount of work one night, and other nights he doesn't do as much. So I don't know exactly when he'll have it, but you're ahead of everybody else if he's doing it. You should be happy about that. Okay.
Well, yeah, I am. But Gerard, here's something else too. I heard you in the past. There were some problems with the state of Maine. I guess some person went on his own and was doing something blatantly in this regard of. Well, I'm up in Maine, and I'm looking at a case now where the city managers decided that they would go against this person up here. And I'm going to be working on a case with that where they went into his property and they were, you know, the guy's disabled and everything. And they were going to start taking containers off his property. And he got very mad. And finally the police told the town manager to back off. But now they're trying to, like, fine him $100 a day or some amount. And they're just causing them problems. So I'm gonna be going to one of the meetings and reading them 18 U.S.C. 241 and 18 U.S.C. 242, conspiracy against rights and conspiracy against rights under colorable law, because they're messing with his property rights. The town of Wilton seems to think that they can tell people what they can and can't do. And the 16th Jurisprudence 256, the state said that the unconstitutional is null and void from the time it is signed, not the time adjudicated in a court of law. So I'm getting ready to fight that battle. So basically I'm going to approach this person and tell him there is a remedy for him. So that's what I'm looking at right here and right now. But Dawn, did you get that?
I'm gonna call John Drash tomorrow.
I would just call him on his phone and try to get him and talk to him directly, because I don't know.
Right, because he's personally handling the case. And,
right, so you should talk to
friend,
him.
I will. I'll do that.
Mm.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Gerard.
Thank you. Yeah.
God bless.
Thank you very much. God bless you, too. Okay. We have Jeremy. I think it says Wisconsin. You are unmuted, Jeremy.
Awesome. I just had a couple of questions for opening a court of record.
Uh-huh.
A couple of procedural things I'm not too sure about, as far as like where these things are filed and like what like numbers would be for like the ticket number that would be on like the templates for the action and the memorandum of law and jurisdiction.
Well, you know, when you say you open a court of record, the language that you use determines that it's a court of record. You state it, and we have examples. As a matter of fact, every case that we do is a court of record. So that first paragraph is the defining paragraph that tells you it's a court of record, and all
right.
those footnotes explain it. Now, as far as your, I don't know, when you say templates and numbers, you know, your form that you're putting the matter in, you know, is generally, you can follow the form that we have. You know what I mean? I mean, they all, everybody uses about the, basically the same form, and the court has certain fonts they want you to use and stuff. You have to learn how to set your paperwork up so it looks somewhat professional. But, you know, when you open a court of record, you're going in, you know, as the sovereign of the court, well, as the only sovereign there. I mean, I don't know if you're going against the state or another person. There's
state.
A different... The state, yeah. So you're the sovereign as far as that goes, you know?
Right.
And the state cannot be the sovereign. So if you look at the cases we do, and we do have tells you how to start an action. I don't know if you went through how to court access and how to do actions. Well, in that jurisdictionary course that's up there, which is very good, by the way, that is written from a common law perspective. See, when we originally took our courses on jurisdictionary, they were written by a lawyer, and he said, don't talk about the Constitution and this and that. So what John did was, once we learned procedure and the matter and the form, he made his own jurisdictionary course based on the knowledge that was gained from jurisdictionary, you know, doing that jurisdictionary stuff.
Fine.
But we did you know, from a common law venue. So if you look at all the examples, which I had taken jurisdictionary course, but I never went ahead and went in and looked at the course that he made, because we were already in court so far along by that time, and I had learned through like on the job training. When I went back a few months ago and went into that course and looked, he did a lot of nice work there. I mean, I'm complimenting him now, because I never really read it through, because I didn't, you know, if you need it, you're going to use it. We're always doing so much stuff. But when I did read that, it's set up really nice. And if you follow that form, you're not going to get hurt. That's really going to keep you in the right jurisdiction. Now, you don't want to argue in the court if you can help it, because that's where they're going to get you by saying stuff that you shouldn't say on the record. Like Thornton says, he says, you know, just object and don't say too much. And if he says, why do you object? If you don't know what to say, you just say, because it is not my wish, and that's it.
Right.
Because they're very stealthy, these guys. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, I argued the case and got all the way to the end, and as I'm tapping my papers on the table and walking out because they were clearly defaulted, he goes, what do you want me to do? And I said, well, I want it dismissed. Well, I gave him permission. So he ruled against me. I had to come back and slap him with a writ of error and overturn him. But, you know, he got me on the way out the door. That's how snaky these guys are. And they think that's going to work. Anyway, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. What were you going to say?
No, it's fine. It's just I've done pretty much buried myself into their jurisdiction. You know, I mean, I'm fighting a personal case that's been going on for 4 years now.
It doesn't matter.
Right, and I understand that it's just I'm up for sentencing in a matter of a week.
Well, that's a problem. It's a problem.
Yeah, a little bit.
Fire like that.
You know, and like I said, it's just something that's been drug on for so long, and I've only recently learned what I've really been robbed from in the last 8 months to a year.
Right. Well, let me ask you. Are you in a state court?
Yeah, well, it's a county court, but I mean the state.
Okay, yeah, it's the state. It's not, you're not in a federal court. You're in a local court. You're in in a town or county or whatever, but it's still in the state. And I guarantee you, if you look at your case and you look at what they did, I guarantee you that there's due process violations.
Oh,
there's probably defaults. There's probably a lot of things that they violated you on.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, look at you're down to the wire here. That's a problem. But the first thing you need to do is you need to get in the federal court. And the easiest thing to do, and I hate to keep sounding like a broken record, but it works so nicely, is that habeas corpus.
Right.
because you can habeas corpus out of that, let them default. At least it gives you a good solid ground to fight. Now, that doesn't mean they won't steamroll you and try to sentence you and try to arrest you, but once you're engaged in the federal court and they got an order and you got all this paperwork going, that's really going to slap them awake when they start seeing the default and the cease and, you know what I mean, and the notice of default and all that stuff. I think it'll save you. So I don't, and look, it's a federal. You know, you got to know how to. You got to get in that court. You, like you said, you don't want to pay for it, so you got to have your file on demand and all that stuff. You know,
To do a writ of habeas corpus from my own court, would that not, you know, be the quickest way to go?
It
about
would be,
doing
but you got a short time to learn. I don't know how savvy you are with it, but look at Bill Thornton teaches it from the court of record, from the sovereign in the court of record. That's the way he teaches it. John has done one like that actually, and that one worked too.
Right.
So you're granting it yourself. Do not ask the judge for the habeas corpus. You will not get it. So open your court. You know, do it from your own perspective, put it in there. Look, if they got 3 days, then you know they're going to default, and that might be enough to save you. I don't know. I don't know how bad, you know, what was going on.
That would be filed and served on the people that would be involved then in this particular case.
Absolutely. Everybody, and including the judge and anybody that touched it.
Mm-hmm.
All the John Does and Jane Does, everybody.
Yep.
You know, the attorneys, everybody, because they're, you know, they're violating your due process, you know, and
it's the writ then that they would be served, the writ for habeas corpus.
Yes, they'd be served. Everybody has to get served. They all have to
from the plaintiff's court of record. Then.
Right. Right.
Okay.
You grant it, you serve it, and then you're filing it in the federal court, though, and you're not paying for it. It's coming down out of the federal court with a federal number on it.
So whatever the district court is for...
Right, right. You're going to go up there, and you're going to file it in the federal court, and you're going to copy everybody the filing, right? So that gives them however many days to answer, 3 days, 4 days, you know, 5 days on the outside or whatever it is. And then what you see, the trick with the habeas corpus thing, too, is you can't drag your feet. You have to boom, boom, boom. When they're defaulted, you got to give them the notice of default. Then you got to get, once you give them the notice of default, then you got to give them the notice of decision. You know,
papers. So once the writ is filed, they've got 3 days if they don't respond.
3 days, right. And so you want to make sure that your paperwork is ready to go. And boom, you hit them with that. And then boom, you hit them with the other paper. And you don't give them a chance. You know, if you give somebody a left hook and he's rocked, but he's not down, you keep going.
Right, right,
you know?
For sure. It's funny because I've actually been working my butt off for the last 6 months to do all of those. You know, all of the templates that I've been instructed that we're using is what I've been working on and trying to fill out with, you know, the action.
Right.
And all of the rest of the, you know, paperwork. So as far as filing that goes, it would go to the clerk of court for the whatever U.S. district court. Would you be able to, like, file that easily? Like I think John was saying once before, to send it certified mail?
Well...
That'd be the best route? Or to maybe just do it in person?
Well, we always do them in person because, look, the clerk gave John trouble. And if you're going to send it in the mail, registered mail... Then what's going to happen is they're going to send it back because they want a fee. Even if you send that file on demand, they may not read it. At least if you're there, you can give them the answers like John did to that clerk.
Yep.
And I don't know, are you in New York State?
No, Wisconsin.
Well, look, I know other people that have filed in federal court, and I know people that were using the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And there was one guy up there telling people to file their complaints in federal court, you know, with these debt collectors violating their rights, calling them when they're not supposed to, and all this other stuff. And his experience is with that the federal courts are nothing like the state courts, and we've discovered that, too. They're actually
I noticed
helpful.
That. We're just calling the clerk of courts. She knew immediately what I was calling for.
So much
and
more professional.
Sent me right to where I needed to.
Right, right. You're gonna. It's like a breath of
fresh air. Even electronically file stuff.
It is. It's a breath of fresh air, believe me. So, yeah, do that. Get it up there. I don't know. I think you should do it in person because you can shove that file on demand and you can kind of push it a little bit. And at least you walk out, you got your number, and you know you got your number, you know, and you're not looking. Mm-hmm. If you're going to be sentenced in what'd you say, 10 days, a week or something?
Yeah, like next Tuesday, the 22nd.
Oh, boy. Well, you need to move pretty quickly. And the thing is they may still do it, you know, and mm-hmm. if they sentence you, you know, let's say they sentence you to jail. Sometimes they do it immediately, but sometimes they give you a week or two. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't know how long they've been since they had the. In other words, they've done the verdict. How long did they wait to sentence you since the verdict? How long have you been waiting?
Oh, geez. I went through 2 years of probation, and then they extended a 2-year diversion agreement. So it's been over 4 years. That, I mean, the case started, and then, you know, I mean, like I said, it's been drug on this long, and now they finally decided to go ahead and find me guilty and sentence.
Okay, so they came out with guilty. When did they find you guilty is what, you know, that's recent, right?
Do what now?
When did the guilty verdict come down?
That would have been, yeah, fairly recently, would have been July.
Right, so they gave you from July till now for before sentencing.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you could, I don't know, you know, you could have appealed it before sentencing. You had so many days. I don't know in their statutory world where you're at, but there is times that they have that you can appeal the sentence and, you know, before sentencing.
Well, and I mean, at any point that jurisdiction is questioned, from my understanding, it's just about universally. That puts a halt to things, does it not?
Well, it's supposed to, but not necessarily in their world.
Yeah, okay,
you know,
right.
I mean, they'll steamroll you. They don't care. Well, the point I'm getting at, and I'm trying to be very gracious about it, is if they put you in jail, now you're going to need somebody else to fight for you. You're not going to be able to do it in jail because they're not going to give you the resources or anything else.
Right.
You know, so you have to seriously think about what you're going to do. You need to have a next friend. You probably, you know, look at, you should start doing a you should get your habeas corpus out right away.
Yep.
You know, and you probably, you know, would have been nice if you could have done it through us, because then it's coming from the perspective of the grand jury. But
right.
I would, you know, look at, do what you got to do for now. And even if you get in there.
Well, it's so quick, you know, I mean, it's like coming up right now.
I know, but here's the deal. Look at, do what you can do and see how you make out. But even if the worst comes to worst, you get your next friend to go ahead and send the affidavit and let us do it from the perspective of the grand jury after the fact. And we'll see if we can't get you out.
Sure.
You should be able to.
Well, I do have people that know what's going on and kind of how, you know, to pick up where I left off if
there
the worst case scenario were to happen. So,
yes, and
you
so
know, I mean,
that's
probably
good.
The best I can do.
You're in good shape as far as friends goes, and you can always come back, and we could always do it for you, and hopefully, you know, you're not sitting there. Okay?
All right, sounds good. Well, thank you for your time and all that.
So we'll keep Jeremy in our prayers that he does well in this crazy endeavor here, because I know it's
really
a lot of pressure.
Appreciate that as well.
Okay, God bless you.
God bless.
Okay, I'm going to go to the next caller, who is Robert.
Yes, Robert Dale here, Illinois State Coordinator.
Hey,
got a question. I was hoping John would be back by now, because I think he's going to be key in this decision, but I have an immediate need. I've been talking with Catherine regarding the habeas corpus on a matter. I've been, Gerard, I've been, you know, traveling without a license to drive, for years. For years. Right. And every time I've been stopped, I've always been able to show my common law affidavit of identification and reason with the officer. He always they've always seemed to gotten it. Never had a problem. They always say, okay, sir, you're free to go. Until just recently, in August.
You ran into the wrong guy.
I ran into a guy that said, you know what, I don't know anything about that. I don't care. We'll let the judge sort it out.
Right.
And now, the reason this is important is because I am right now a prisoner in my own domain here, because I there's an arrest warrant involved. And so that along with the fact that I'm also fighting two foreclosures, and I'm trying to clear my name and overturn a case where they I had to serve 90 days because I used the common law court of record. It was contempt of court for using the court of record. Can you believe that? And so I've got a lot of things hinging on this. If I go to jail on this goofy arrest warrant for this ticket for failure to have a license, I've got some serious problems. And so,
wait a minute. First of all, failure to have a license should not put you in jail.
Well, I'll give you a brief rundown of what happened. Basically, the officer stopped me. I said, I'm not driving, I'm traveling, and gave him the whole thing.
Right.
And he said, I don't care. So I showed him my identification, and he comes back with a different name on it that he got off the license plate. Okay, different than what I use, who I am. And I know we don't do the whole fiction thing, but basically I just went into court, and I basically did a plea in a common law, non-statutory plea and abatement. Bill Thornton is up on all of that stuff,
right,
and
right.
I've done that for years. And so I scheduled a pretrial hearing before the trial date. A notice of ex parte hearing to challenge jurisdiction and correct the record, and also a demand for abatement based on the plea and abatement they never responded to. When I got there, of course, they always hold it till last because they don't want anybody to hear it. I went up there, and he says, are you this name? And I said, no, sir. Here's my affidavit of identification. He says, if you're not this name, then you have no standing. And I said, well, I'm the man they stopped. So I think I have an interest in this case. And he said, I am, and I had filed with the clerk my paperwork. So I had a duly scheduled hearing, and he refused. He said, I absolutely will not have this hearing. And I said, we have a duly scheduled hearing, sir. We should be able to go on. And he basically just refused. He asked the sheriff to usher me out of the courtroom. And as I'm leaving, he says, now let's issue a warrant for failure to appear. And of
this
course,
sounds like Shades of Terry Tressel. Yeah.
Yeah. I turned around. I said, are you kidding me? And the sheriff says, keep moving. He wants you out. And of course, the court reporter took down a lot of it up until he said, stop typing. And he told her, but I'm going to get the transcript of what she did get.
The reporter to stop typing.
He did. So that's meddling with the record. And then when he realized he goofed because it was my hearing, there was no requirement to be there for failure to appear, he realized he goofed. And when the actual trial day came up, he bumped it up to the date that I actually had my own personal scheduled pretrial hearing. So he changed the date of the trial after I left the courtroom to the date that I was there. This gets, so basically, talk about corruption.
He gets you for failure to appear, so he.
Yes, he had to make it good. He had to make it good. So I basically I appealed it into the appellate court to get it out of his hands immediately, and the very next week, of course, I had a local police officer knocking on my door. I know better than to answer the door. There's no law that requires me to do so. So he goes next door and asks questions, and they said they don't know. I called the police department, and I said, what's up? And he said, there's a warrant out for your arrest for failure to appear. And I said, well, I said I was actually there. I challenged jurisdiction and so on. He says, I don't care. We have a warrant, and you better turn yourself in, or we're going to basically catch you one of these days if we have to camp out and catch you. So basically, like I said, I'm a prisoner. I've got two foreclosure cases I'm trying to fight. I can't even get out the door to file papers. And if they arrest me, I'm in serious trouble. My wife just recently passed away during all of this stuff, and that was part of the reason why I needed to get a habeas corpus. And I was hoping to talk to John and say, is there any reason why Catherine tells me that they may not take my case? And I can't understand why. John said that
why would they not take your case? The only trouble is he's got so many that are like due right now. That's the problem.
Well, I understand that.
The
only thing is that I think the reason is that the name on the affidavit of identification that I showed was not the name on the license plate that's attached to the license plate. And there was, by the way, when they stopped me, there was no cause. I didn't speed. I didn't do anything. They pulled me over because they had an automatic license plate reader that said, this guy doesn't have a license to drive. And that was the reason they pulled me over, not for any other reason. So that in itself, as I understand, is also another violation.
The trouble is you got to end up in the federal court with all that. In the meantime, they got their posse out looking for you.
Yes.
I don't know what to tell you as far as you need time, and I don't look at. I'm sure. They have what's the point of the warrant to arrest you? Oh, because you didn't appear. But meanwhile, you did appear. He changed the date.
Yes.
You got paperwork where you filed for that date,
yes.
They returned and they gave you that date.
And I show a ticket that shows the date several days later. And he changed it. The clerk told me that it was changed, and nobody can change a date but a judge. So I really was hoping to talk to John about the habeas. Right. He basically changed the date because it was my pretrial, and he realized I had no requirement to be there. And he did a failure to appear warrant. He had to justify what he did.
He should go to jail.
He should be absolutely hung. Absolutely. That's treason. That's warring with the Constitution, which is treason.
Habeas corpus, look at you. You need a habeas corpus. There's no doubt about it.
I do.
How to get that, like tomorrow, I don't know.
No, not tomorrow, but if somebody's working on it, I'll be happy.
You know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But here's the deal. First of all, you got to keep your head low because they're looking for you. You need
to am.
For a little while. I mean, I'm not telling you to.
I'm doing that.
But you need to bide time now. You know, look, he's already made up his mind that he wants to arrest you.
Yes.
Now, things that he did were so bad. First of all, you need to put a judicial complaint on him immediately. You need to, even though it's their system and that, you need to shine light on that. And you need to make a complaint. I would even complain to, I don't know who, besides the judicial,
there's a review board, Illinois Judicial Review Board.
Yeah, and Illinois is horrible. I know from the
yes.
that they're horrible.
Yeah.
But I would complain anyway because you don't know. Look, everybody knows they're horrible, and there may be a guy in there that's actually going to look at this thing. So I would get it out there to somebody, you know?
Yeah.
You need people. You need people to show up at the court. People need to be calling, you know? And you need to bide some time. Now, he's got this warrant out because, and it's a false warrant because,
yes.
you know, and so besides your habeas corpus and that, you know, it sounds to me like you can write paperwork, so you're
yes.
picking up from most people that call in that are late. I would immediately start a tort on him in the federal court.
Okay.
Start a complaint, and maybe you could even go to, I know like here they got the special prosecutor has been arresting judges and lawyers down in the city because they're so corrupt here, it's getting out of control. I don't know if Illinois has got anything like that, you know. I mean, these courts are really out of control, but every now and then they get so bad. I mean, the federal government went into, I think it was Chicago, one of those courts over there. They completely took over the state courts. They said, it's too corrupt. You guys can't run them anymore. They closed
yeah.
them down because it was so bad.
Yes.
But
they said that the Chicago courts were a criminal empire. The circuit court was a criminal empire is what they,
no,
what
I
they
don't
ruled.
Know. Look, this guy is blatantly bad.
Yes.
You need to
he's not scared of you because he doesn't think you know what to do. He figures you're one of them crazy sovereign people with the name thing and all that. It's unfortunate.
Yeah.
We know better than to go there because that's the thing that sets them off. And you could have avoided all this by not making that argument.
Well,
you can always
I don't have a license. I've always used that as my identification.
I understand that. You know, when you get in the court, you say, I'm not that guy. They've studied this, and this is how they can get you for contempt and throw you in jail. So, you know, you got to figure out some other way of addressing that, you know. and this guy's ignorance, and like Thornton says, there's nothing more frightful than ignorance in action, and you're seeing it now.
Yes.
And this guy is clearly wrong, but he clearly doesn't give a dang.
Right.
You know? And so you're going to have to get you're going to have to slap him with some kind of a case. Now, look, if you can start an action on him in the federal court, I mean, I would complain to anybody who will listen, any special prosecutor, anybody who's looking into anything in Illinois, I would get this guy's name out as best I could. But in the meantime, you need to sue him, and you need to bring a case in, and you need your case to get in front of a superior court's judge's eye.
It's in the appellate court now, but is that good enough, or should I do federal on top, alongside of the appellate case?
It should be in the federal because it's a due process. It's a violent. Look, the state's never going to poke itself in the eye, and that's what you're asking them to do.
Yeah.
Now, the appellate could come down and say, behave, but I seriously doubt it. You know, I mean, if they think they're going to have trouble, if there's some kind of shakeup going on, you happen to hit it at a lucky time, you could get lucky, but I would not count on it. I would get in that federal court. I would put the case into the federal court. I'd go against the judge. You know, I would sue him. I would sue him, civilly and criminally, and I would ask that charges be taken out. Maybe he needs an arrest warrant. You need to make a complaint.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, I would ask. I would make the plea to the federal court that they cease and desist him and arrest him or what, you know what I mean? You need to speak in some very serious language to that federal judge, that court, that this guy is out of control and he's changed dates just to arrest you to make an example out of you.
Yeah.
And look, that's probably your best shot at this point.
So you think I should take it out? You think I should take it out of the appellate court or just appeal it directly to the federal from the appellate? I mean, what's a good strategy?
I'm not sure. Look, they're going to – you might have to take it out of the appellate court. The appellate court I don't think is going to help you anyway. We haven't had any good experiences in the appellate court. We had high hopes, and they sit there three judges looking like three frogs in a pond staring at you. That's my experience. So I don't think that you got – a one chance in a million in that court of them doing something for you. And the trouble is, if you got it in the appellate court, you see, the federal court will tell you, oh, well, you're in the appellate court. You haven't used up all your remedies yet. But you see, the thing is they're really not allowed to do it. You have to make the case on the fact that they're violating your unalienable rights. And you need to quote some of that stuff that we put in, how that is a federal action when it has to do under the laws of the United States and the Constitution. It has to go to the federal court. They really have no jurisdiction to rule on it.
Okay.
That's what you got to make sure all that wording goes in there so that they're kind of forced to take it. And they can't send you back down to that appellate court. And probably you should pull it out of the appellate court because I don't know if it's going to be a conflict having, case.
Yeah.
Cases in three courts, that's unusual.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when you go in, they ask you if you have something pending in any other court, and the appellate court's just going to be a monkey wrench for you because, look, the case is really in the county court with this judge, and the appellate court, they probably don't even want to look at it, and you can't have too many going. I think it's going to be a conflict for you.
Well, is there any chance that while I'm doing all of what you're suggesting that someone could also look at make kind of like ensure that my case is on track for the habeas because that would be my saving grace.
Absolutely. You already talked to John about this. Did you start paperwork or something?
I did through Catherine, but she says John's going to kick it out. I said, why? And she says, well, you know, because we've kicked out other cases like this. I said, I've got too much at stake here.
Why? So, why should think John's going to kick it out? Because of his name thing?
Because of my name, because of the name that I have used for years, and that's who I am. And because of that, she says they're going to kick it out. I said, well, that's the name he used on the ticket, so go with that. Well, okay.
Yeah, we'll have to discuss it. I don't, you know what? I don't know anything about that. I don't want to address it tonight. We got other people on the call.
Yes, I know.
I've already spent a lot of time with you, but
I appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the best. The advice I gave you is the best that I have. I'm not saying it is the best advice. I'm shooting from the hip here.
Yeah.
You know me. I know just enough to make myself dangerous. So that's my disclaimer. Okay.
So okay, that's why I was hoping John would be there, but I appreciate you, Gerard. I appreciate your addressing it.
Yeah, so we'll see, and I'm sure he's going to hear this if he, you know what I mean?
Yep.
Then we got it taped, and I'll
yes,
ask him.
Yes, if you could bring it to his attention, I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
Make a note. Yep. Thank you, Gerard.
Okay, welcome.
All right, take care.
Yeah, bye-bye. Okay, next question. Boy, we got a busy night. We got some stories tonight. Oh, my God.
Just real quick, I heard part of that.
Yes.
Now, what was the situation? He used a different name than his real name?
Well, he's been driving without a license, right? He's not using the all caps name, and apparently he's changed his name from what, you know, he's doing. Like, it's the, you remember what his name was doing, and he changed his name around to, of the family of, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like the family of me, you know.
Well, if that's how he's known in the courts, we can deal with that, I think. We would use his real name and then a.k.a. The other name.
Yeah.
And we don't have to give any reason why he used that name. It's irrelevant. You can make any name you want up and live under that name. Why not?
Well, he's been doing it for years, so he does have kind of a precedent. And you're right. You're right. I mean, look, if we're sovereigns, we can certainly do that. And, I mean, it may even be that he's putting the family name first of the family of, I don't know. But I think it's a minor thing.
Yeah, but his affidavit has to be a plain story, period. You can't get into the crazy language that deals with the fiction and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But did you hear the judge? He set a preliminary hearing before the hearing, and then when he went in and the judge says, is he here? He goes, well, no, he's not, but I am, and blah, blah, blah. So then the judge had them issue an arrest just like they did with Terry, right? He had the guy escort him out. And so then when he realized that hearing was his own hearing that he scheduled, he didn't even have to be there. The judge changed the date to the first hearing to that date so that the arrest warrant was good. So he committed fraud, saying he didn't.
Yes, put in the affidavit. He's got to answer it.
That's what I said. And look, that judge needs to go to jail for that little ruse.
Mm-hmm.
You can't change the date.
Hey, by the way, we're going to be having a meeting with all of those people that are in the IRC group.
Yeah.
I believe we have 82 or 81 people, something like that, in that group now, and it's growing. And anybody else who wants to learn how to write papers, that's the group. And this is a papers from the perspective of the grand jury, of course, not to write papers to go into court,
right,
per se, but for the grand jury to write papers in the court. And but in any event, we're going to have, I think, on probably Wednesday. I got to find out. They said Wednesday morning. Wednesday morning is not good. It's got to be Wednesday night so that everyone can
make it. Yeah, I'm at the dentist again Wednesday myself.
Yeah, a lot of people can't make it in the morning, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning or Eastern time or 11, whatever time they have been having it. It's got to go to the night, I think 9 p.m. I think it's going to be Wednesday at 9 p.m. And it'll be in the room that they've set up. Anybody that's interested, or anybody that's in IRC, should go and ask the leadership there what the access phone number is and also the access code. Now, in order to get into that meeting, you must have you must be part of the IRC, so you have to join the IRC. And we're going to be talking about, particularly about writing affidavits and how to write a good affidavit so that you can tell when people write an affidavit, you can help them correct the affidavit and bring it back to reality. And now, anybody that comes into the IRC, we have to verify who you are. We have to have a real phone number. We have to have, obviously, an email that works, and we will call you on the phone to verify those things. And if it's not a verifiable situation, you won't get into that group. Because if anybody causes problems in that group or sabotages, we are going to press charges against them for sabotage. And we will seek an indictment. Everything we have to do. Because, you know, that's what we have to do from this point forward. So anyway, to really learn how to do this paperwork from the perspective for the grand jury, as administrators of the grand jury, you need to learn this stuff. Anyway, go ahead. Back to you. Go ahead, Rod.
I'm sorry. I'm talking and my stupid mic is muted. Should have saved them breaths for breathing. I unmuted a VIP dialer.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes, this is Richard in Jefferson County, Iowa.
Okay.
And I have two minor questions and a major one. The first one, I've tried for several months to join the Common Law Advisory Committee because that's where I belong. But Don does not return my calls. Maybe you should appoint someone to run that committee because there's no one is at home.
The Common Law Advisory. All
right, well, let's talk to Don Boxley, and that committee is underneath Don Boxley's committee, or also Nathan. What's Nathan's last name? But anyway, Nathan and Don Boxley are co-chairing that, and that particular committee falls underneath the IRC. So, talk with them and see about him trying to get contact with Don.
Okay, well, isn't Don, he doesn't put his last name on the website, but there's a Don who's the leader, and he doesn't return calls.
Yeah, I think it's Don S.
Anyway,
I call him Don S. You know, I have to go look up his last name, but I just refer to him as Don S. But
okay,
yeah.
So how do I get a hold of Nathan, because I can't get a hold of Don?
Well, there's two Dons. There's a Don Boxley also, and there's Nathan. Go up to the IRC, look, go to the dictionary, look up IRC there, and find the committee leaders there. Or go to the committee itself under committees, click on IRC, and then go down looking for the leadership.
Okay, so I'll try that. My next quick question is, how do you prosecute under 18 U.S.C. 241 or 242 if the prosecutor will not prosecute?
Yeah, you're not going to win in these courts with those violations, although we do use them once you do a default in the federal court, you can use them. And, for instance, if you do a habeas corpus and they default the habeas corpus, and they will default the habeas corpus, then you can then go for a show cause on why a judgment shouldn't be taken against them because they defaulted, they've defrauded the court, they didn't answer, they had a duty to answer, you know, all those things. And then you can add in the points that you were taken out of a court that illegally, kidnapped you. And, you know, you go through the 41 and the 42 and the 18 and bring all that together in the court, in a federal court. Now, they'll probably default there, too. The judge will try to help them out. They'll make a motion to dismiss or a motion to do something, and they'll try to do it before the 30 days are up so that they don't have to answer. And you have to object to that, overturn it, and let them know that you can't do that. This is a court of record, and the court of record doesn't give the opportunity for motions to dismiss. You see, here's the key thing about a court. And people really need to understand this, and they need to stand real strong on this and put it really into the face of the judge and make, because he knows. And if he knows, you know, that should get him to be a little concerned about you. But the bottom line is this. There's only one thing that you need to do to make a prima facie case, and that is put in an affidavit, an affidavit of truth. That's it. That you don't even have to write a court paper. You could stick your affidavit of truth into the court and run right off of that. Now, they must hear it. And it must be rebutted. If it's not rebutted, it stands as truth. And that's how you're going to win the second default, is because they did the first default, and they'll ignore the second default. The judge will dismiss the case. You'll overturn them immediately, give them a writ of error and overturn his ruling, and let it be known that it still stands. You know, you only got two more days. Or you could be graceful and let the other side know, hey, I'm going to give you an extra 3 days because of what the judge did. He screwed things up for 3 days. I'm going to give it to you. They're totally going to ignore you. They're going to pursue. They're going to say you're a dreamer. You know, they're not. The judge is going to start to realize that there's a problem here, and he may push for a solution for them to make some kind of a conclusion here. But if not, it doesn't matter. You'll get your default. And you'll only be able to collect what's reasonable off your wherefore clause. So you better write a really good wherefore clause in your order to show cause. And you got to make it reasonable, and you got to be clear on what it is that you're looking for, because you're only going to get that, and the case will be over.
Okay.
You can make that criminal, too. You can demand, especially if you've been in jail, you can demand that they spend 5 days for every day you were in or something like that, and that's reasonable. You can demand certain things on the criminal side of things. You know, they seem to think that criminal courts and civil courts are separated, and under common law, that's not true at all. Both can run at the same time, civil and criminal. Matter of fact, it's a requirement in a criminal. If someone, stole your ox, okay, they have to give you back 4 oxes, you know. So they've committed a crime, and the crime may require some other punishment, possibly. Maybe it was armed robbery, you know. I don't know. And so they have to pay back restitution. That's civil. And they have to then pay the penalty of a crime if that's what's required. And you can try to require that and push for it. But usually you're better off getting into a jury before you push on that level. You now have to have an educated sheriff that's got to see what's going on and understand it, and they don't. So you're not going to get the arrest. Again, you could start priming the sheriff. As a matter of fact, I believe right now, Gary, are you here? I believe we faxed out to all sheriffs now. We got a fax machines up and running over the weekend, so people can take that paper we talked about a week ago or so, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, I forget when we read it out, concerning the sheriff, and everybody should be sending it to their sheriffs. And every state coordinator should be out there with the district coordinators pushing and organizing every single state to really make sure that the state coordinators start working with their county organizers and everyone else they can get working with them. And let's get this out personally to every sheriff in your state. So if you work collectively, if you got 10, 15 people working collectively in your state, and you got 40 or 60 sheriffs, then each person can call 3 sheriffs and discuss the matter with them and send the papers in. And then everybody can do just calls, just everybody get on the phone, just spend a minute or two on the sheriff, telling the sheriff they're watching. They expect them to do the right thing and start to learn the law and obey the law, or they'll be required to leave office. You know, we the people will remove them from office if that's what's necessary for them to perform their duty. So this is the campaign. I think we need to write some instructions on this, and we'll try to do that and get that out in through the email, and we'll start putting out, through the courtroom observers alerts on this nationwide.
Okay, can I ask my major question now? I'm about to challenge one of NLA's core principles. I have brought a lot of citations, if you let me present them. It has to do with the concept of police powers. I've listened to a lot of the Monday night calls. This is the very first 30 of the earliest ones. And I've never heard you mention the concept of police power in any of the Monday night sessions. Bouvier's Law Dictionary on Police Power contains 7 pages on it, so it's an important topic. And let me quote what Bouvier's has to say. Definition of police power. The powers of government inherent in every sovereignty. The power vested in the legislature to make such laws as they shall judge to be good for the commonwealth and its subjects. And
you just hit on the key there, the common power given to the legislators. The legislators have to write the law for the police powers.
Yeah.
Okay? You understand that, right?
Yeah.
Well, go look in the Constitution and see the power of the legislators, and you won't find the power to give them police powers. The only power of police powers that we have given the federal government, and we've given the federal government police powers under the U.S. Marshal, and it's broken down and explained in the Judiciary Act of 1789 under proper legislative authority. And the only other is left is that which falls under common law, which is the sheriff. Other than that, any other police officer out there is working for a corporation, because remember, they're not working for the trust anyway. So you might be able to make a different argument there from the trust factors, but not from the corporate factor. But even you'd still lose on the state level anyway, because the authority hasn't been given. So why would we need anything other than a constitutional officer, since they can't write statutes, which is their statutory enforcers, so they're code enforcement officers is what they are. And so they can't write these codes against us, and since they can't write these codes against us, why do we even have them out there? Now, they may be assistant to the police, you know, to the sheriff, in the sense that they maybe pick someone up that's robbing a store or doing something that is definitely wrong. But what they're really doing, those police officers, ultimately, are making citizens' arrests. They're not really operating under any authority.
I've seen a citation that says that the federal government has no true police powers. But the police power is actually a part of the common law. I will be getting into that. There's a definition from Bouvier.
Well, the police power would be only in the sheriff's then. Where else? What other? You know, you can have, look at it. When you get into equity courts, and equity courts are chancery courts, you got to understand it. That's the history of the world. Equity courts are chancery courts. So for the first time in history, we the people, under the Constitution, changed the equity court because we saw the need for an equity court. We changed that to a common law procedural court. They, too, have to obey Article 6, the law of the land. And the law of the land is defined in two ways. First of all, it's defined, of course, in all the laws that are written in the United States, number one, and any legal law that's written in the state courts, which ultimately are statutory, and they really apply to the people who are elected servants. They don't apply to we the people per se. They apply to the elected servants. Now, anything beyond that is a statute that controls our behavior and can't be done. Remember, common law can have a much higher penalty than any statute if you injure somebody by doing something stupid, you know? And so, and people will realize that real quick, and we'll be teaching our children in school real quick, and we'll know. We need the law is serious now. But there is no authority anyway. Where do you get the authority? If the only law that can be applied is by a constitutional officer, the only constitutional officer, because clearly no police officer on the city, state, or county level, or town level, or village level, none of them are constitutional lawyers. They're there to do the work and the duty of the corporation. They're there to give you code violations. That's all they do. Everything they do, they write a ticket. That's what they do. See?
Well,
they don't have no power or authority. Now,
you're covering a huge amount of territory, and I just wanted to cover basically one point having to do with police powers. Let me start with the definition on page 2616 of Bouvier's. It says, police power, it is the application of the personal right or principle of self-preservation to the body politic. And the principle I want to make is this. The police power under the common law is protective as well as punitive, which is contrary to the principle that U.S. vows that in the absence of a victim, there can be no crime. The victim can be harmed in the future. The police power is the power to write statutes that apply to the people to protect from harm. For example, if you're a contractor, and you've talked about this, if you ignore the building codes, you have caused no harm now.
Well, that's, of course, that's commercial. Of course. No argument there. Of course, you have to have rules. And look, if you go into the Constitution and you read the powers in Article 1 for the legislator, they have the power to write statutory laws in certain areas. They have the power to write rules and regulations that affect all of us. We all have to obey, and we break it. We are guilty of a crime under those terms, okay? So you have to be a responsible individual, okay? Now, on a private side, your behavior is your business. Look, if you want to stick a needle in your arm, as long as you don't do this in public, because now you're causing another problem, which would be ultimately corrupting the morals of society, corrupting the morals of a minor particularly, because minors are in the streets. But, you know, if you want to stick a needle in your arm and take some dope and you end up killing yourself, that's your business. Now, of course, that's a terrible thing, and if you know your neighbor's doing that, you should try to talk them out of it and help them out. But they got to stop, okay? If you want to smoke marijuana, that's your business. So these things, of course, are all made crimes. If you want to drive without a driver's license, that's your business. If you're going to drive a commercial vehicle, you need a driver's license. That's acceptable. That's the law. Okay? I carry a driver's license, and my position on holding a driver's license, even when common law gets in, I'll continue to hold it, is so that I have the ability to drive a commercial vehicle if I so choose. And it also is a great identification card, and it's also something you know, you can use to have an affidavit done. So it identifies you. So it's got some good usage, so people don't need it. And the Supreme Court has ruled over and over again, you don't need it, okay?
Yeah,
now, look, if you're driving down the street and you're going 80 miles down the road on a 30-mile limit, which is what is the suggested limit and the reason why it's suggested, well, then, yeah, of course someone could take you. You don't need a statue. It's common sense. You've put people in society in risk. You put our children in risk. And the sheriff and his deputies can pull you aside and actually bring you in for a potential crime. I mean, they could fingerprint you, go through the whole thing, and they got to go out and get a grand jury and indictment, though, because if it faces a potential jail sentence, and I presume that would or might or could, they still got to get an indictment. But they'll get your information, and they'll get the grand jury, and they'll bring an indictment, and the people will decide. Look, common sense is common law. You don't need statutes. The people know, you know in your heart what's right and wrong, and you know when you're putting someone in danger. If you're on a highway and the suggested miles is 60 or 65 and you're driving at 80, that's no one's business. There's no problem with that. There are plenty of places that there's an unlimited driving, unlimited mileage on a highway, and they're just as safe and maybe even safer than the highways that do have the limits. You know, you don't need street signs to stop people. You put a crosswalk there when you come into a town, and you put a sign there, you know, yield to pedestrians, and they stop and people move back and forth and traffic goes. If you're in the middle of New York City with huge traffics and jams, well, maybe lights may make sense there. You know, it's all common sense. And you come to that light at 3 o'clock in the morning and you can hear the crickets as they're soul around. You stop, you look around, you go past. You shouldn't get no ticket for passing the red light. There's no one there. This is common sense. This is common law where we, the people, govern ourselves. You know, if you go to our page and take a look on all this information, and I'm trying to think the page. Oh, yeah, the sheriff's page. Which, by the way, we have a new website. It's actually a link, which links back to our site anyway. But it's the power of the county sheriff. And if you go there, okay. Oh, hold on, Stan, this page here. I did it in the wrong place. Hold on. Go to powerofthecountysheriff.com. Okay, it'll bring us to a page on our website. Okay, this is what we want to give to the sheriffs. We want the sheriffs to go out and read this page. And if you come all the way down to the bottom of the page, okay, you'll see some information. You'll see John Stossel does a 15-minute clip on spontaneous order. Now, spontaneous order is a study that's been around for quite some time. We have a copy of that study right up here on spontaneous order, which says that people are social. You know, that's our nature, are social. And we come together and bind together in communities. And it is a spontaneous order about that. You don't need rules and regulations to govern our behavior. It is normal and natural, okay? And we will do so. And if we train our children in school to reinforce, you know, being polite to individuals and, you know, and giving each other the right of way and understanding, you know, that they're going to be held liable should they do something that puts people at risk, that's all we need. We don't need mommy and daddy telling us what to do or giving us fines on it. We also have a thing there called the traffic control, the road to nowhere, which also versus spontaneous order. And this is about a half hour, 35-minute clip, and this will blow your mind. When you watch this case, because everybody that was interviewed in this town with heavy traffic said, you can't take lights away. And they said, we're going to do it. We're doing it in so many weeks. And people thought that was the craziest thing in the world. People are going to die. You're going to have all kinds of problems. There's going to be chaos. And you go see what happens. The people in that town, last time we had heard, it had been a year. They don't want their traffic lights no more because it works a hell of a lot better when the people just go through spontaneous order, even in traffic. You know, people have been programmed to think that we have to be controlled by someone. Look at, you need to control yourself, and ultimately you need to turn to God and have God control you. But you need to control yourself. That's what you need to control, and most people will. You know, you're driving down the street, you got this big, 3-ton vehicle wrapped around you and someone cuts in front of you or something, or something happens and you're yelling, you're screaming, you're honking, you're on, and so on and so forth. Well, you know, in the streets, if you're walking down the streets and someone accidentally cuts you off, you're not going to yell and scream and honk. You don't have a horn to honk. You're going to act very differently. But once you take that situation and you act in society normally and even within vehicles, everybody's going to be very courteous. You're going to be totally surprised by watching these videos and reading this study on spontaneous order, that everybody is very courteous and very much aware. And you know that actually the accidents went down. People being hit by vehicles went all the way down once they got rid of the lights. Why? Because people come up to lights and just think about it. Next time you come to a traffic light, you think about it. What are you watching? You're watching that red light to turn green, and your eyes are up to the left looking at the light, and all of a sudden it turns green, you're hitting the gas, and you didn't see the woman or the person or the child coming from the right of you walking in front of your car, and bang, you hit them, okay? That's the kind of accidents that are caused by traffic lights. And so, again, study that, and you'll see. And then people will be held accountable for not, doing the right thing and being something that is dangerous in society. If someone's driving drunk, the sheriff better pull them over and take away the keys, drive them home, and drop off the keys in the courthouse, give it to the grand jury, tell them to go get his keys from the grand jury. That's what they need to do.
Do you agree that there could be a crime if there's a threatened danger?
Do I think that there would be a crime if what?
Do you agree that there can be a crime if there is a threatened danger?
Well, absolutely. I just said that if you're driving down a street that's 20, 30 miles an hour, and you, especially school signs and different things, and it's a narrow street, whatever the case may be, and you're driving 80 miles an hour in a 20, 30 mile an hour zone, and you've got children and people in the streets, yeah, that is a crime.
Your principle is that absent a victim, there can be a crime.
Right, but in society putting society in danger, and you started off with that, now you're going to the other side. I agree with you, and common law agrees with you, that when you put society in danger, when you put people in society in danger, things could be done. And it doesn't have to be a criminal act. It could be something that this person needs to understand. You can give them community service. You can make them go to a special class. Especially someone drinking and driving, you know. You can take away the keys from their car and say, hey, look, you go through this program, and then you'll talk to us in 3 months when you finish that program, and we want to see a whole new attitude about you, because if you ever get against... Because if that person kills somebody, forget manslaughter.
Look at, what was the word he just used about a perceived danger or a future... What was your question?
I don't know. What was the word?
Danger.
Try it again. We're not getting it.
Yeah, you're breaking... Oh, a threat? Danger? Threat?
Yeah, you pull out a gun, that's against the law. You put a gun in my head, that's against the law. That's a crime.
Threat? Danger. Yeah, I mean, a perceived danger I wouldn't go with, because who's perceiving it? A threatened danger, I don't know, what's a threatened danger? You need to identify that a little bit more. Who determines whether it's a threatened danger? I mean, if the person that's doing it says, I'm going to shoot you, well, guess what?
Well, that's different. That's the fault.
Okay, now, what kind of threat and danger are you talking about?
Okay, well, take, for example, the city of Chicago. It burned down, and mm-hmm. if the city did not have the police power to demand or require that they space the buildings, then they wouldn't be able to control fire.
That's not police power. No. And I'll tell you, I want to get it. I was a builder and construction manager, and I worked with engineers. And let me tell you something. If you're a contractor and you do something outside what they suggest is a normal code, and you don't abide by those codes, now it doesn't even matter whether they fine you, whether you do that or not, but you build a building or you build something and you ignore the codes and you don't have an engineer check, because you don't need the town checking. Now you have your own engineer put the certification. I wouldn't build anything without having an engineer giving me a certification, and that makes me absence of any kind of a risk factor. And if that building collapsed for some reason, it had nothing to do with me, because we conformed to what was minimum code and requirement to make it safe. And if I didn't do the necessary things and tried to save some money here and there and didn't put the necessary reinforcement there or whatever the case may be, and that building collapsed or a wall collapsed and it killed somebody, I'm liable. Okay, so it becomes back to personal liability, and that's what common law is all about. We don't need to write that down. We're not living in mud huts. We're living in buildings that are structured.
And if the building inspector, if somebody calls the building inspector in after the fact and he finds that you did that, you're still liable because it's a perceived danger. Absolutely. If they can prove that you used slipshod thing and you didn't follow code, you didn't do proper engineering, even though it didn't kill somebody, and it's a perceived danger, and they can prove it, absolutely you committed a crime. You skimped. You didn't do the right thing. You're liable.
And the worst thing to use is a building inspector. The best thing to use, look, as a builder, I throw the building inspector off the site. Go away. I don't want the city to involve. I don't want the town. I want no one to bother me. You know what? I got an engineer. He's going to certify it. He's got a certificate. He's educated. He knows everything that's necessary for whatever engineering requirements are for stress points and so on. So, you know, again, any and look at. If we go back to a society of this type and we train our children, and children are actually educated again, you don't need to go to high school, you don't need to go to college unless you're going to become a doctor or something special like that. Other than that, you need 8 years of school, and that 8 years of real schooling, real education, a Jefferson education would be equal to and better than the college educations that you get out today. And when you come out of that school, you'll have sense, you'll have common sense, you'll have knowledge, you'll have respect. And again, we bring honor in the courts, and we're applying the real law. That'll get into the streets very quickly. And people will appreciate that a heck of a lot more because there are very few people that purposely go out and break the law as far as, you know, just generally because that's what they do, you know. But, you know, those group of people, they're criminals, and we'll get them and we'll put them in jail if necessary or whatever whatever the trial jury decides to do with them. But we got to stop going to mommy and daddy. We got to grow up, and we got to be responsible for our own actions, and that's common law.
There was one important point that I'd like to make. The administrator oath, you include in there that absent a victim, there can be no crime.
That's
correct. The state cannot be a victim.
Correct.
But you've already established that if there is harm, like if you're doing 60 and
now we're looking. Look, we're looking for society being the victim. Ultimately, we're looking for the grand jury to make that decision, not a legislator. Okay, and I'm a sheriff or I'm a deputy. I'm driving down the street. I see this guy swaying back and forth. I pull him over. I smell alcohol. There's no doubt the guy's drunk. Maybe I'll do a blow test on him or whatever the case may be. I'll take him and I'll put him in my car. I'll call for a tow and I'll have the car towed to the pound. I take the guy's keys away from him. I'd find out where he lives. I'd drive him home and I'll say, you'll get a call from someone. Get all his information. I drop the keys off at the court for the clerk to get to the grand jury so that they can discuss this matter with this guy. And they're going to work out a deal with this guy that he's going to take, because if he doesn't take it, they're going to put him into trial and give him his due process that he's going to want if he doesn't want to take that deal. And the trial jury is not going to be as nice as the grand jury would be.
Yeah,
okay,
but when that cop is filling out an affidavit of what he saw, he's filling out the sworn complaint.
Well, absolutely, but it's not so much the cop. It is also the fact that you got a blow test done on the guy right there. That's proof positive.
Right.
But
and
yeah,
the other thing
it's a real report.
It could be a person on the street that says, look it, so-and-so comes down here, and he drives fast, and he's going up on the sidewalk. He's putting my kids at danger. You have a sworn affidavit. They can go after him. He needs to answer the charges because they're a victim, right?
Just so you know, though, when you go back and dig deep into this, a person working for the state, an officer of the state, cannot be a witness. Okay, so if you have a regular city cop or someone like that, they're working for the state or the city or the town, they can't be a witness against you. Okay, but a sheriff can, because he doesn't work for the state. He works for the people, and his deputies work for him, who works for the people. He reflects and is the extension of the arm of a constitutional officer. And when they make a sworn affidavit, it's on behalf of the people. Everything the police officer, everything a sheriff does is on behalf of the people directly, without the state, without any corporation or any form of the state whatsoever. It's directly for the people. So all of this works together. Now, look, we need more deputies on the beat, probably. These police departments will have to shut down once the law is brought in, because they won't be able to file their codes. And once everybody realizes they don't have to pay their fines, they're just going to collapse. That's how they pay for them, ultimately, is by doing all this, collecting fines and stuff, and then they get money from the state and from the federal government to really push this forward and all this other stuff. All that stuff stops. Where's the money going to come to get all those police officers? So there's no more code violations, but maybe they need some more officers on the street for deputies, and so the deputy, the sheriff, will get a bigger budget, and he'll hire some more people. And if he really has a problem and needs more people in a situation, he can call the people themselves posse comitatus.
I think you need to change the administrator oath, that line that says, absent a victim, there can be no crime, because we've already brought up several examples where there are victimless crimes. Driving too fast.
They're not victimless crimes. They're crimes against the people putting them in arm's way. And the grand jury, but the people make that decision, not the legislature. Don't you understand that? It's a total different thing. If the people in one accord say, yeah, look it, they operate from the heart and the mind, okay, and not from the legislator. And every case is different, every single case. And they have to figure out the facts of the case. They have to decide on whether this person is innocent or guilty of whatever it is. And then they have to use the heart to make other decisions. They got to consider mercy. And they also got to consider restitution. And jail should be the minimum thing done by most cases. It should be rare to go to jail, because basically it's restitution is what common law is all concerned about. You know, you look at the Israel, the nation of Israel, I never heard anything about people put in jail. Okay, they had to pay the restitution, okay? And God was clear. If you got a murderer, you have to have two, I think it is required, two witnesses for murder. But you got a murderer, God says kill them. Take their life. But if you have a real just system and not this system, because we can't trust these people with a death penalty. We just can't trust them.
I dare say that the term victimless crime is an oxymoron. If it's a crime, there better be a victim.
Right.
And it better be a person, a people.
Right.
Right?
Absolutely.
Whether it's a community. A victimless crime is, I don't know, a victimless crime would be like if there was a cop at the Tree of Life when Eve ate the fruit and he slapped her hand and he arrested her before she ever got in her mouth. So he's enforcing free will. And there's no other victim than herself. That's a victimless crime, and we don't want that. That's what the state wants. The state wants to be the God. God takes care of those problems that are his statutes. He deals with us. But when we go into other people's kingdoms and step on their toes and damage them, now there's a victim, and that's what the people, that God has empowered the people to take care of that.
And that brings us to another level here, because you see, if you're going to make the king of the court God, then God is going to rule in the justice system. He's going to have to rule in the educational system, because that's common law. It has to be taught. So you will have a more godly society, okay? And that's the key to this whole thing. If you don't have a godly society, you can't have it. And Benjamin Franklin said, you know, this very thing, you know, either you make God your king, or you will have a tyrant, a man. You'll have a tyrant. So it's either God or tyrants. There is no other choice. And no matter how good the man is that you make the king, he's going to die one day. Or he may have all of a sudden an epiphany of doing things totally different and be not the person you think he's going to be. You know? So you don't know.
Well, the other thing is the attitude that we don't have the ability to rule ourselves. And that was Hamilton. They didn't think that the common man had enough sense to make these decisions. It's kind of like the liberals. They're going to tell you what you need to do with your money because we're too stupid. And what did Jefferson say? He said, if you think the common man's too uneducated, then educate him. Don't take his rights away. That whole punitive thing where, you know, no, we're going to take it from you because you're not capable of doing it. And you don't get a chance anymore. We're going to tell you what to do. A lot of what we're experiencing is the fact that there's these people that want to rise above everybody and tell them what to do because they don't think that we have enough sense to make the right decision. Look, I know people, when you tell them that we don't need speed limits on the road, they're horrified. How can you? Look, if you need that stupid sign to tell you, look, a lot of times you got to drive slower than the speed limit. If it's snow or ice out, I don't care if it says 55, you might only be able to go 15. And if you're doing 55 when there's snow or ice, guess what? You're a perceived crime because you're going to kill somebody. You know what I mean? It takes.
Discretion.
You have a certain discretion.
But also, you know, suggested speed limits can be put up. You know, when you drive the road, there are suggested speed limits for trucks. Cars go at a certain speed, but then you see those other white kind of speed limits that are suggested speed, but you and a car don't have to obey that. They're suggested. Well, all speed limits should be suggested.
Well,
and people need to use common sense. Obviously, if the speed limit is down to 15 or 20 miles an hour, obviously there's some risk factors here, and it doesn't make any sense for anyone to drive 50 miles an hour down that road. And that's putting people, children and people into harm's way, and that is something that the grand jury has to look at. It's got to be dealt with.
There are police officers that write tickets called speed imprudent. Right? You ever hear that?
Yeah, I haven't, but go ahead.
Oh, yeah, where they don't even put down how much you were speeding. They just put down speed imprudent. Like, they'll do that in an accident where it's clearly clear that you were going way too fast for the turn of the road, but they have no witnesses or anything. The only thing they have is the fact that there was a 600 foot long skid mark to the tree.
And I don't think you get that anymore, do you?
Yeah.
With all these cars.
Right. Exactly.
You don't have control over that. There's no evidence left anymore.
Right.
Can I say something?
Yes.
I'd like to read to you what the courts have said defining the police power. It's described by the courts as follows. Quote, unwholesome trades, slaughterhouses, operations offensive to the senses, the deposit of powder, the application of steam power to propel cars, the building with combustible materials, and the burial of the dead may all, says Chancellor Kent, be interdicted by law in the midst of dense...
Whoa, says who?
Chancellor Kent.
Do you know what chancellor means?
Well,
you know what it means when you call someone a chancellor? That they're in a chancery court?
It
means they're the king of the court.
Uh-huh.
It means the people and the law are irrelevant. Ultimately, he can do whatever he pleases. And that's what we have in America, chancery courts. That's the problem. They're supposed to reflect the will of the king. That was done under the king originally. And they're supposed to reflect the will of the king, but the king could not be everywhere, so he appointed chancellors. And chancellors will go out to make the law, to enforce the law of the king. But when they came into situations where the king didn't work on those things, they had the power and the authority to make the law up right then and there. And that's what we have in American courts today. So
have you heard
of what
Kent's
you're saying?
Commentaries?
Who?
Kent's commentaries. He wrote the commentaries on.
I've heard of him.
Chancellor Kent was. Chancellor was just his title.
Exactly. The fact that he's a chancellor brings him right away from common law. You got to, look at. If you go get educated, they will. First of all, the best books to buy. As a matter of fact, I didn't even announce this. We're going to be having Brent Winters be a special guest on one of our upcoming Mondays. We had a conversation with him, and it was recorded. I'm going to have to try to get it up there. I haven't got the time to do it lately, but I'll get it up there and put it up with the radio interviews. And again, we had a good conversation with him. But in any event, he wrote a book called Common Law. And he really laid it out the way it is, in the way the actual history of things actually took place. And half of his book was footnotes, and that's not an exaggeration. When you open that book, half the page is footnotes, sometimes two-thirds of the page is footnotes. And so he really gave all the authorities and all of the backup in his footnotes of everything he uttered. And he followed through the process how it really was and how it came to be in England and all the way up even into America. And so when you go through that, you will find that there's a false common law, that they'll call it a common law, but it really falls under chancery and you got chancellors. And that's exactly what happened in America. The very same thing they did in England, they did here in America. Chancery courts are not permitted in the United States. And yet the Judiciary Act of 1789, which was signed just 3 months after the Constitution was signed, okay, they came in and said that the courts will operate under the rules of chancery. What the heck are they doing here? Already the enemy was in 3 months after the signing of the Constitution. 3 months, okay? Marbury versus Madison, I think it was 1883, it dealt with that related to the way it is void and null and void. Now, they laid out a lot of other good stuff in there. They had some good legislation, but you had the enemy there that snuck that other thing. You see, when America took on the Constitution, Chancery Courts were already operating here. And the king was really pushing for the Chancery Courts because he was trying to get our founding fathers. And every time they'd go after our founding fathers and they pull a jury, a grand jury would refuse to indict them. So they had the problem. And they, well, of course, they had the Chancery Courts here already. But they were pushing them harder and harder and harder. And then when the Constitution was finally signed and they had the law of the land, Article 6 of the Constitution, the Chancery Court still continued. And there was that war, that battle, the Chancery or the courts of men versus the courts of God. The courts of Chancery are all courts of men. The courts of common law are the courts of God. Two different kings, a man or God. And you take your choice. You know, I got a person who sent me an email because we're doing Bible studies. And you know, what are we doing Bible studies? Well, people don't have to come if they don't want to come to the Bible studies, but you really should come. But nevertheless, you know, one of the points that the person made was, look at all of the evils of the world because of religion. And he's got a point. It's true. But it has nothing to do with God. It has to do with Satan. It has to do with the people, the children of Satan. These people are interested in egos. And as soon as you have power, the first thing these egotistical people want to do is control and take power. And they take power of the church just as well as they take power of the government. And that's why the evil was there. It has nothing to do with godly people. It had nothing to do, obviously, with God himself. And there was always that other side. And there's always that war, the spirit against the flesh. And how much more in churches? You know, and God already said, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and spiritual wickedness where? In the high places. And he was talking about the churches, okay? And that's in the Bible back when, you know, when, I don't recall if it was written in Romans or what epistle, but that's where it's at. You'll find it. Matter of fact, I'm pretty sure it's in Romans. Paul probably penned that. So, what? You know, we have to use our common sense and look at. You know, we have never seen the world today, the modern world has never seen a nation under God, a real nation under God. The last real one that ever was there was back in 1600 BC, and that was Israel. For 400 years under the rule of God, okay? Everything was ruled by God. And it's very simple to rule by God, just act under principles. It's common law, common sense, the heart, sense of honor, sense of justice, sense of mercy. Very, very simple, okay? And bring in the attributes of God. Do the godly thing. And why do people have to go to jail for this and that and every little silly thing? America puts more people in jails than any other nation. And why? What the heck is going on here? If people do wrong to people, they need to fix that wrong. And then, you know, and they like to get these people, put them in jail and let them out and say, you can't have a gun no more, you can't vote no more. They take away total citizenship. What is that about? How do you bring the person back into society? You know, you watch some of the old movies, and when the cowboys got out of jail, they gave them their guns back and their horse, and they're on their way. Well, the horses were probably dead, so they probably didn't get the horse back. But anyway, you know, they get their guns back. And that's kind of suggesting and telling us something. You know, and you can't, you know, how are you going to live in Alaska without a gun? How are you going to? There's a lot of places that you can't live without a gun, okay? So anyway.
I just wanted to say we don't disagree with everything he brought up about Chancellor Kent. Some of that stuff needs to be regulated. You're working with gunpowder. That's in the public interest, and that's a commercial activity. And yes, the people can give the legislature the right to make laws that have police power over that. Absolutely. I mean, we're not arguing that, but there's certain things, you know, look, at the minute you give government power, the tendency is that the government always wants to grab more power, and pretty soon they're telling you what time to go to bed and what time to get up, like 1984. Get up, do your exercises there, Branson, or whatever the guy's name was. You know, that's where we end up. We end up with the state telling us everything to do, and instead of becoming adults, we become more like children.
Can I give you an example of that?
Yes,
well,
go ahead.
Well, we kind of run out of time. We're 11:57, but make it quick.
Okay, well, on that one point, for example, the prohibition of raw milk, compulsory use of seatbelts, and numerous other laws have a rational basis in protecting individuals and society, but they're not necessary and proper. i.e. they are minimally intrusive upon liberty.
Well, hold it. You right off the bat, you know, raw milk is another question altogether. I'll let Gerard answer that one a little bit. But the seatbelts, let's take a seatbelt. I was, when I was very young, I was an ambulance driver and an emergency medical technician. I did that for quite a few years. And let me tell you something. There was no law to wear a seatbelt. I wore a seatbelt all the time. I've been wearing a seatbelt all my life. Why? Because I worked on an ambulance, and I saw what happened when people were thrown out of a car. Yeah, there are times when wearing a seatbelt might be a problem. That's a good point. But that's rare to begin with, okay? So, you know, look, you teach your children, train up a child on how they walk, they should walk, and when they get older, they will not depart from that. That's a promise from God. So why don't we just train up our children how they should walk? Let them know. Don't give them the BS. You know, give them the truth. Tell them, look, you know, it makes all the sense in the world because this is what happens to you if you drive without a seatbelt.
You didn't wear a bicycle helmet and you rode in the back of a pickup truck. I know you did. Don't lie.
So, you know, you got a lot of things. Look, people can work this out. We don't need government doing it for us. That's the bottom line to this whole thing. We have grand juries.
John, you're a good man, but you're just not going to learn anything if you don't listen. You've dominated this conversation.
Oh, well, of course. Of course, because I know what you're saying anyway, and I've been through this stuff. And, well, look, you already brought up two issues automatically that became a problem. The raw milk deal, Gerard,
you didn't even hear what I was about to say. It was on your side on that.
Go ahead.
Okay. So this judge was bringing out this point. Like, raw milk was one of them. And then he said, and quoting now, and other things too numerous to mention might be suggested for legislative interference, each with a provision for a severe penalty for its violation.
Is
this division of
the guy again?
No.
Listen, wait. He said they're not. Go ahead. I know what he's talking about. Go ahead.
With a division of the penalty, perhaps, between the informer and the public, till one would be placed in such a straitjacket, so to speak, that liberty and the pursuit of happiness, the incentive to industry, to the acquirement and enjoyment of property, those things commonly supposed to make a nation intelligent, prosperous, and progressive, and great, would be largely impaired and in some cases destroyed. That such an extreme would be regulation run mad and is quite improbable, 'tis true, but it would be possible without limitations of some sort if a police law be conclusively legitimate merely because it promotes, however trifling in degree, public health, comfort, or convenience. That was State versus Redmond, 114 Northwestern, 137.
Right, so they're making our argument. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, so why were you bringing up? You changing your mind now? You thinking what we're thinking?
No. I
what he's saying is they've considered these things in the fact that they're making these laws, right?
Exactly. It's called the police power, and it is declared by Chief Justice Shaw that it is much easier to perceive and realize the existence and sources of police power than to mark its boundaries or prescribe limits to its exercise. This power is, and must be from its very nature, incapable of any very exact definition or limitation.
America cannot have police power and continue under what they claim liberty and the Bill of Rights. It's they're not compatible. You have to have a constitutional officer. Well, look at, if you're going to go get yourself a police power and you're going to give them people the ability to write you a ticket, to give you a code enforcement, you know, their code enforcement officers, and I go to court and say it doesn't apply to me, they're going to let me go.
It must be based upon necessity. That's the whole point.
No, but first of all, all the courts, let me ask you a question. Why do you think that all the courts that deal with these code enforcements are all city, town, municipal courts, village courts, and sometimes county courts, but none of them are state courts? Why do you think that is?
It's because they are operating at the lowest level, closest
because
to the people.
Because all of them are not courts of record. You go into the New York Constitution, and I'll bet you find this in most states, okay? The New York State Constitution tells you exactly what the courts of record are, and they did not mention any of these other courts. And when you go in and argue the courts in a courtroom with these town courts, all they're interested is their codes. And when you bring up the Constitution, their eyes glaze over, and they get really upset with you when you start pushing that. And they don't even know what to do, because most of them don't even even have any training in law anyway.
Look, we've always instituted limits on police powers. Number one was probable cause. Number two is we had Miranda rights. We were always limiting the police powers because they were always getting out of hand. I mean, look, yes.
They never should have been tolerated.
Necessity. Our forefathers said most of the wrongs that are done to the people are done under the guise of necessity. Now,
right.
Is that police officer deciding that it's a necessity that he's going to pull me out of my car because he thinks I'm doing something dangerous? I mean, does he have probable cause?
And that's
role
of the grand jury, is to verify that necessity
right.
is being properly applied.
Right, and right. none of those code infractions get a grand jury anyway. That's right.
Well,
we don't have grand juries
grand.
Now. We've lost our voice. That's
well, look
the whole problem.
Well, that's what we're bringing back. We're bringing back the common law, and people make their own decision, and the people will decide on right and wrong, and that's the way it should have been. We're under self-rule. This is the American experiment.
I forgot your name, sir. I'm sorry. What's your name?
Richard.
Richard, if we bring back the people in the grand jury, all this stuff we're arguing about is going to take care of itself because it's going to filter into its proper place, and we're going to have freedom again. And we won't be picking hairs between what's commercial and what's this. I think if we can get the grand juries back in, we won't have to sit here and argue about any of this stuff because I think that the people will take care of it. Just like they took care of Prohibition because they said when the prosecutors brought it, they started ruling on the law and they said not guilty, whether they had the evidence, they didn't have the evidence, and prosecutors stopped bringing it because they were losing, and they didn't want it on their record. So finally they repealed it. But it was done through nullification. It was done through the grand juries. And
Spontaneous order.
Right, and I think if we look at you, we agree. You and I agree that we've lost the people in the equation. When you lose the people in the equation, what you end up with is a mechanical machine. I used to be on a town board, and people would come in and they want us making laws and this and that. And their dog ate my chickens and all this crazy stuff, and. We had people that said there should be a mandatory sentence for this and a mandatory sentence for that. And I said, look, if you want mandatory sentences, you don't need me up here. You need an IBM machine punch card, and you put the card in, and the result comes out. It becomes very mechanical. It becomes very hard, and there's no exceptions. When you put people into the mix, now you can make the decisions. And look at like a speed limit. Yeah, let's say there's a speed limit, but if somebody's bleeding to death and you're going over the speed limit to get them to the hospital, there's an exception to that rule. A cop has an exception, an ambulance, they have lights. But look, I'm also a fireman, and they told us, driving with those lights on is no excuse for killing anybody. They'll still put you up on charges because if you did something that a normal, prudent person wouldn't do in the same situation, you're liable. This is what they tell us today. Even with the red lights, and I'm allowed to run a red light or a stop sign, they said, but God, don't you kill somebody because they'll take you up on charges. So, it's all how we conduct ourselves.
Right, with that, we're going to end our program. We're already 6 minutes over time, 10 minutes, 11 minutes over time, and we do have people in the queue, but next week, get in early, and we'll make sure that the people who were in the queue that didn't get in will get in first call. But with that, we're going to end our program. Thanks, everyone, for coming. We're going to be starting a newsletter very soon, which will tell the schedule of all the things we got going on here at National Liberty Alliance and special announcements. We're going to keep everything very short so you can breeze through it very quickly and get the necessary information you need. Get involved in committees, get involved with, all the work we're doing at National Liberty Alliance, and please give $5 a month or more, support what we're doing, and let's take back America. And anybody who wants to learn about the King, you can join us on every Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here in the Monday Night Room. Our Bible study is on the harmony of the four Gospels. All right, thanks, everybody. Good night. Have a good day.
The actors and jesters are here. The stage is in darkness and clear. We're raising the curtain, and no one's quite certain whose play it is. Then, if we'd known just how right we were going to be, for we dreamed a lot and we schemed a lot and we tried to sing of love before the stage fell apart. Oh.
Well, how do you read an actor indeed? Go read.